This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
El hombre de los moleculos. The molecular welcome. Man.
Welcome, one and all, to another edition of your longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in Place to Be Nation history.
You messed that one. You messed in all of Place to Be Nation, Greg. Come on, we changed the catchphrase. Weeks ago, we've been doing
you,
it for weeks.
You changed the catchphrase.
Yes.
I didn't change a thing.
Why are you doing Bill Cosby?
I don't know. You, Theo, you changed.
That's a throwback to our second episode ever when you did the Shane McMahon Bill Cosby. That was good.
When you put the pudding pop in the back seat of the back seat of the pudding pop. Anyway, we do welcome you.
Listen, he's been alleged to have done many things, but I don't know that he's ever put his pudding pop in anybody's back.
Well, that's neither here nor there.
But it was there.
Oh. Anyhow, allegedly. Pudding pops and... Yes, allegedly. Pops aside, welcome everyone to another rousing edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We are your longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast at all.
There you go.
Place to Be Nation, as my colleague would want me to say.
We've been saying it that way for weeks, and all of a sudden
you just
reverted back all of a sudden because you forgot.
No,
because
no,
your
no,
mind,
no, 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 no.
Your short-term memory and your old age is going to crap, and so you automatically reverted to like 2 months ago.
No, because I didn't say anything about Place to Be Nation pop. I said in all of Place to Be Nation history.
No, you didn't say
history.
It. You left out the all. That was
I left out the all. I left out the all, but I thought it was an implied all.
There is no. You don't imply with a
catchphrase.
Are
you dying? Is this conversation killing you right now?
Many things are killing me. This conversation is not one of them.
Well, one can only hope. But sorry.
One can only hope this conversation is not killing me. Yes, I agree.
Yes. The
For God's
Place
sakes,
to Be Nation
get to the damn point.
Headquarters. The headquarters here in Vancouver, British Columbia. As you can tell, Nick and I are in good spirits tonight. We're both having wonderful days and enjoying the lush scenery here in Vancouver. I would have to say that the installment of salmon ladders that we ordered last week for the studio has gone really, really well.
Mm-hmm. Because whenever you put in a salmon ladder, Stephen mysteriously shows up, and I've been enjoying that.
Yes, the scenery has been quite nice this time of year. But in all seriousness, folks, we do welcome you to another edition.
When are we going to move to our summer headquarters on Fire Island, by the way?
Oh, I have a summer home. I have a home there. Why?
That's what I just said.
Well, I have a home there. I don't have a studio. I just have a home.
Well, we can make a podcast studio out of any room, really.
Good point. Good point. But what about Sanjay?
And things continue to make the list.
That just made the list. In any event, we hope that you enjoyed last week's Love Fest for the greatest of all Green Lantern stories, the Sinestro Corps War, because we have another Love Fest scheduled for you. We are recording this episode on Valentine's Day 2017, and what better way for two guys to spend Valentine's Day than talking to each other about an animated comic book adaptation.
Yep, pretty much.
In this case, Nick and I are talking to you about what is, in our opinion, and therefore is correct, the greatest of all of the much-heralded DC animated movie archive. We are talking about the 2010 film Batman Under the Red Hood. This is an adaptation of a story from the comics called Under the Red Hood, I'm sorry, it was called Under the Hood, just Under the Hood. And that was by writer Judd. Now, this was, like I said, an adaptation of it. But this kind of did its own thing, and they basically gave Judd Winnick a chance to rewrite his own story because he came on as the writer of this movie, which is, as an aside we'll get to later, something I wish WB would do more often is consult the writer of the actual story to do the screenplay. But it's based on a comic by Judd Winnick and Doug Monkey that brought Jason Todd back to life after what was 20 years of him being dead.
God, Death in the Family comics. Was what, 87? 88?
87 or 88, I think. 88, and then he came back in 04?
Yeah. 04, 05? They teased it in Hush, which was 03.
03.
Yeah, and then
02, 03, yeah.
Then they followed and actually did a year later, I think. Now, granted, I wasn't reading comics regularly at the time when it happened, so your memory of this is probably going to be a little better than mine, because I've only read the actual story once. So when it comes to discussion about differences between, you know, the film and the, what's the word I'm looking for? Oh, the source.
The comic?
The source material.
The source material.
I think you'll have to, I'll lean on your expertise there.
Yes, I was reading Batman regularly when the original Under the Hood came out, and that was kind of, if my memory and my timeline serves, Judd Winnick was the guy after the guy, because the guy that had to follow Hush was Brian Azzarello, who came on and did the fantastic and underrated Broken City storyline.
Right, right.
Judd Winnick took over after that, if memory serves, with a Scarecrow story arc called As the Crow Flies. Mm-hmm. I think he did a Penguin or a Black Mask story arc. Then they had the rise sort of Black Mask around that time as kind of the central Batman villain around that era, which was kind of an interesting turnabout for that character.
And remind
me,
how long did Winnick stay on for a little while? Because after Infinite Crisis, they did 1 year later, and he did, and in the wake of that, he did Face to Face, right?
No, that was James Robinson.
James Robinson, okay, never
James
mind.
Robinson. Yeah, Winnick left at right after Infinite Crisis. So
Wait, okay.
Yeah.
Now I'm a little confused. We're going to have to talk about the timing of the story. Okay. So in the original comic book story, the mechanism they used to bring Jason Todd back to life is Superboy Prime beating on the walls of reality.
Right.
Which happened in Infinite Crisis.
Right, but they did not actually explain how, if memory serves. Now, here's another mention that my memory would be better than this. I actually haven't read this story in probably 6 years, at least. Even though I like it. I think it's a good comic book story. I really liked it when it came out at the time. But my memory of it is they brought Jason back, and they didn't actually explain how he was back until much later.
Not much later,
after the story was over. And because at the time, Winnick said the story was about the effect that Jason's return has on Batman. It wasn't about how he came back. And then after that, they would explain that. And the way they explained it is for Boy Prime, as we'll get to in a little bit, which was one of the things that I think Winnick got a chance to revisit in this movie. But anyway, so the book itself was I thought, a very strong story, very entertaining and interesting story. A lot of chances, given that Jason Todd was considered one of the, you know, Uncle Ben type characters that was going to stay dead. They brought him back, and it was a big success. And now Red Hood sees more popular B or C list characters. So it certainly worked out in the long run. But this animated movie was a direct-to-video adaptation pretty much of the story. And it takes lines of dialogue and entire scenes and subplots and plots straight out of the comic. A lot of it is straight out of the comic. But the changes that are here are very good changes, and we will get to that in a minute. But as we like to do, folks, with animated adaptations here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys, or with any product that we watch, we want to watch the movie, put the subtitles on, and invite you to watch along with us as we kind of use the film to guide us along and remind us of scenes here and there that we may have forgot. So what I'm going to do right now is, unless Nick, do you have anything to add before we start the movie?
No. No, I do not.
Well, in that case, why doesn't everyone get their streaming devices or their DVD copies ready? And we will all hit play in 3, 2, 1, go. And so, Nick, what was your knowledge of this story going into it? Had you read the story before seeing the movie?
Yeah.
Or had you never
read? I read the story fairly soon after kind of becoming a larger, you know, it was during that college run when you and I were becoming friends at some point, because I was kind of trying to catch up on, you know, some of the basic introductory level stories that you needed to know to understand current DC at the time. And of course, Jason Todd's death has always played a big role, particularly in the Batman mythos. So that was one of the ones I sought out and read, and I think that's probably the time I've read it, so it's probably been going on a decade for me, but I remember really enjoying it at the time, even if I didn't understand it as well as I probably would now, what with the context of having actually read A Death in the Family and A Lonely Place of Day in the years since.
And right off the bat, we're getting into the changes in the story. Because
here, they're able to use, they choose to use Ra's al Ghul and the Lazarus Pit as the means of Jason Todd's resurrection, rather than the Admiloki punching the walls of reality angle they went with, as what I'm assuming was some sort of loose tie-in to Infinite Crisis.
Yes. Man, there's so much going on here. It's a shame to talk over it, but we really need to get into the backstory of this. But I'll just say, this is one of the best usages of the Joker that I've seen in a movie. Outside of maybe Mask of the Phantasm, of course, The Dark Knight. The introduction here, he is legitimately frightening in this movie.
So,
John DiMaggio.
I was about to say, should we go ahead and address the elephant in the room? Is that this isn't Mark Hamill?
No, this is not Mark Hamill.
Right,
this is John DiMaggio.
I feel like that's a point we need to go ahead and address up front.
Right, right. This is John DiMaggio, who is best known as the voice of Bender on Futurama, if anyone's watched that.
Yep.
But don't expect Bender's voice if you go into watching this movie. This is a sadistic version of the Joker that I don't know that we had ever seen up to this point. We'd seen Mark Hamill go, you know, crazy and violent, but this is a Joker that almost seems sadomasochistic in a way, as we see right now, as he's literally beating the life out of Jason Todd.
Yeah, this is easily the darkest and most brutal Joker, probably with the only possible exception being in the animated film, being Batman Beyond: Return of the Joker, because they did some pretty psychologically dark stuff and messed up stuff there with the character in that film as well.
Right, and it was really interesting. Well, let's go ahead and talk about that Joker thing, and then we'll get into more of the backstory of the changes that are made here. Mark Hamill had, you know, is still the iconic voice of the Joker. Everybody knows him. I would make the strong case that after Mark Hamill, when it comes to animated Jokers, this is by far the best that we've seen.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of other ones. The Young Justice one was awful. I remember that.
Oh, terrible. Yeah, absolutely terrible.
I liked Michael Emerson as the Joker in Dark Knight Returns, although it was a very different take on the Joker. That one's always been the more, like, androgynous, borderline sexual obsession with Batman, you know, the Frank Miller take.
Yes, that was the David Bowie Joker.
Yeah,
yep.
David Bowie Joker. But I liked that one as well, but I would agree that this is probably, of the other guys who have tackled it in animation besides Mark Hamill, this is probably the best. But am I wrong for, as much as I enjoy this portrayal, is it wrong to kind of wish that it had been Mark Hamill?
I don't think it's wrong. I'll be honest. I don't think Hamill could have improved this, to be honest. And this is no knock on Mark Hamill. Mark Hamill's amazing. He's the best Joker. But I don't know, just something about this take that DiMaggio just nailed it. And I think the number one thing that he got was he didn't go in doing a Mark Hamill impression.
Right.
And I think
this Joker
the
first thing you'll notice when you hear it is it's a much deeper voice than you're accustomed to from the Joker. Because everybody kind of plays the Joker in that medium to high pitch range, and he goes a little bit lower and a little bit more guttural with it, and it's very different.
Yes, for sure. So now let's get into the backstory a little bit. You mentioned Ra's al Ghul. That is the biggest change in this story. This movie, of course, has a lot on its plate. If anybody that's listened to our show or read our columns in the past knows that we have a big issue with Warner Animation's firm adherence to the, what is it, about a 70 to 75 minute runtime on all
72 minutes, exactly.
72 minutes. And that's frustrating because so many of their movies feel, even though they're good, they very rarely put out a bad movie, but they often feel like they're incomplete, like there's more that they could have done with it.
Well, they often feel like they're tremendously rushed. The one that jumps out to me is Green Lantern First Flight, in which we get the recruitment of Hal Jordan, the training of Hal Jordan by Sinestro, the bonding of their friendship, the turn of Sinestro, and the fall of Sinestro all in one movie. And it feels like it's just happening at warp speed in the back half of the movie, where it's boom, 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 with no real anything to breathe, no real character moments. And a lot of the movies suffer from that. By and large, they're generally of high quality. The voice acting is great. The animation is great. It's just so often they choose to try and jam way too much story into each film, which is why things like, oh, Batman Year One, which is a shorter story, fits the format perfectly with such a breath of fresh air. Their approach to Dark Knight Returns, where they chose to do two movies as opposed to one, was a breath of fresh air. And even though the prologue they added was awful, it was nice to see with The Killing Joke that they didn't really have to trunk anyway and kind of fully do the story that was there.
Right, I would agree with that. But you know, I think by and large, movies tend to be very good to excellent. But I think that in this case, there was concern because they had to fit. This movie's trying to do a lot. They have to fit in two iconic Batman stories, not just one. They have to fit in Under the Red Hood, but they also have to fit in Death in the Family.
Right, because you can't without the other. At the time, these animated films, they all existed independently of each other. There was no connected universe. They were not telling one long narrative. And so you couldn't assume that an audience was going to have the knowledge of Death in the Family going into Under the Red Hood. I suppose now, because my understanding is that the Batman films and the Justice League films since Justice League War are all tied in together. So I guess now you could do them as two separate films, but you know, at the time, that wasn't really a possibility, which is why they gave you that little prologue that you needed right there at the beginning that we just saw wrap up. And I would argue that's a pretty, you know, that's as good a job as you can possibly do of getting the main thrust of Death in the Family down into one, you know, one little, what was that, 5 to 7 minutes probably?
Yeah. And I'll be honest, I think a big factor comes down to the fact that they let Judd Winnick write it. Because mm-hmm. he was able to write the dialogue of Ra's al Ghul in such a way that without it feeling like they were beating you over the head, it got across the point, the what they were trying to accomplish with the film, which is to say that you know, they have to explain why the Joker is beating Jason Todd to death with a crowbar. They have to explain how it's in that situation. And they have to do it subtly without it being so expository that it drives you nuts. And they did that with just a few lines and got this really creepy, sadistic death scene in. And of course, they were able to have Batman, you know, tragically come up short on saving partner. And you have Ra's realizing what's happened and realizing the tragedy of the moment. I think the moment when Ra's drops the glass is a big, big moment in this movie. And it's all part of the changes that they had to make. Because in the comics, really quickly, A Death in the Family is the story in which Joker killed Todd back in 1988. Jim Starlin wrote it.
After DC Comics fans actually voted to kill the character.
Voted to kill Jason Todd off hotly contested 900 contest in the days when 900 numbers were a thing.
Kids, get your parents' permission before calling.
That's right. 1-900-909-9900. That was actually Mean Gene Okerlund's hotline, ladies and gentlemen, not the DC Kill Jason Todd hotline. But anyway, so they do the story, and it admittedly, my memory is murky of the details, but somehow the Joker ended up in the Middle East somehow and lured Batman and Robin there and murdered Robin But then he had diplomatic immunity, so he couldn't be punished, see? So it
like
was a
the guy
convoluted.
In Lethal Weapon 2.
Yes. That's exactly right. License revoked.
Diplomatic immunity.
Yep. License revoked. So that was that. And then years later, you get Jason coming back from the dead as a result of Superboy Prime punching a hole in reality, which is tied into Infinite Crisis, which was an excellent event that is indicative of the somewhat lazy Superboy Prime punching reality defense for bringing Jason back from the dead. But Jason's death in the comics was huge. Huge part of Batman's mythos. Would you agree, Nick?
Yeah, for a long time. I mean, the iconic image of the Robin suit hanging in the glass case in the Batcave. I mean, that's what it pays homage to. I mean, they even did that in Batman v Superman with a Jason Todd suit hanging there. So it has certainly placed an indelible stamp upon the character. I mean, that story is directly responsible for the creation of characters like Tim Drake, because without Jason lived, yep. There would never have been a need for a Tim Drake, and I would argue probably subsequently no Stephanie Brown or any of the other numerous characters that were affected by that, the butterfly effect, so to speak, of that decision.
Right, and I would also say that I think Jason's death for many of us enhanced Batman's tragedy, because we've talked before, Nick, about how at the point in Batman's life that he was at that point, it's kind of hard to keep buying into the fact that his parents' death is still the overriding thing in his life, that that's where he drives all of his guilt and suffering from, is that one event. With Jason, you had a more recent event, and more importantly, you had an event where rationally, as an adult, he could blame himself for what happened.
Right.
Bruce blaming himself at 10 years old for what happened to his parents kind of doesn't make a lot of sense. Bruce blaming himself for a young boy that he recruited to his mission dying, that's a whole nother thing. And so it added a layer of pathos to Batman that gave us, in large part, the paranoid, suffering, isolationist Batman that we, the two of us, loved so much in the 90s and early 2000s.
That we love so good.
That we love so good. So that's all a bunch of comic book backstory. In the movie, they had to truncate that. They had to condense that down into that opening scene where it's established that Jason is Robin. And importantly, through the animation and through the artists involved, they had to display what Jason's personality was like through his facial expressions. And just that little scene, if you recall, Nick, when he smiles and spits at the Joker, blood pouring down his face, that tells you everything you need to know about Jason's character.
Right. And here on screen, not to interrupt you, but I know where you probably want to jump into this, we're getting the introduction of who plays a pretty integral role in this film. And I know you have long been a fan of what they do with Nightwing in this one.
Yes, and just as a disclaimer, I've had some streaming issues, so I'm actually behind. I'd say I'm probably about 10 to 15 seconds behind where Nick is. But in any event, yes, Nightwing in this movie, this is actually, by the way, I believe the first, I can't remember if Mystery of the Batwoman had a minute or not. Yes, I think this is the first.
Mystery of the Batwoman had a minute.
First good animated movie that.
Mystery
Nightwing.
Of the Batwoman is not that bad. Come on.
It's not bad, but it's not good. It's
okay.
Just kind of average.
It's all right.
It's an average movie. That's all it is.
Would you rather watch Mystery of the Batwoman or Sub-Zero?
Sub-Zero.
I think they're closer. I think they're pretty close, honestly.
I don't. I think Sub-Zero is a lot better than Mystery of the Batwoman, personally. But that's another debate for – that's another show. Hey, maybe we should watch that one somehow.
I have a copy.
In any event, this was the first good portrayal of Nightwing that we saw in an animated movie. And I will make a controversial statement here.
Greg's this about to probably, sully the name from Lester.
This was probably the first good Nightwing that we've seen ever, including as far as animated goes, including the animated series. Because I will never sully Lauren Lester's name as a Robin. He was great as the voice of Grayson Robin. I never really liked what the Gotham Knights era of the animated series did with Nightwing. I kind of thought he was a little bland on there. You know, they had the one good episode with Catwoman, even kind of, you know, okay. It was pretty good, but it wasn't. You never really got a chance to see Nightwing shine. This is Nightwing in his glory. The animation is beautiful. The way that he fights differently from Bruce, which is so important because in the comic, one of the best parts is reading how Bruce views Nightwing fighting and, like, analyzes his style and compares it to the other Robins. It's so good. And they managed to get across how agile, athletic, and quick he is, whereas Batman is more brutal and straightforward than is Dick. And just as important, again, this is where I will sully a little bit Lauren Lester, even though he was great as Robin. Neil Patrick Harris, yes, that Neil Patrick Harris, does the voice of Nightwing on here, and he is perfect. It's hard to explain until you see the movie, but it's hard for me to read Nightwing in the comics now and not hear Neil Patrick Harris's voice. That's how great he is in this movie. This is the Nightwing that is my favorite comic book character. The way he's drawn, the way that he fights, his dialogue is perfect. Again, because Judd Winnick is a comic book writer and knows how Nightwing talks. On top of that, the voice acting from Neil Patrick Harris, he has that perfect mix of, you know, sarcasm and wit and the lightheartedness, but he anchors it with a somber when it comes that he cares about Bruce, he cares about the Bat family, and he cares about his job and takes it seriously. He just doesn't take it as seriously as Batman. And also, the movie doesn't turn Dick Grayson into a jobber like the comics often do. He's able to hold his own. And right now, I'm behind you, Nick, but I'm watching them fight Amazo, who's one of the more powerful Justice League villains.
You're a good
Which is right out of the comic book. I'm having all streaming issues right now on HBO Go, but I've had them for a few days now. But Amazo is a Justice League villain, but this is right out of the comics, and it's a depowered version of Amazo. He doesn't have all of the full powers that you would expect. And Batman and Nightwing, they're so good together, end up taking him out relatively easily. It's just a great illustration of Bruce and Dick and their relationship with each other.
Well, not to draw attention to, you know, what happened in the movie 5 minutes ago, but to call attention to what's happening on screen now, they're actually inside Ace Chemicals, and we just saw Batman reliving the Red Hood falling into the vat of chemicals. So the implication here is that the origin we see in The Killing Joke is indeed canon. So that's an interesting implication. And also, one thing I noticed, Greg, is whenever they do flashback scenes here, the suit that Batman is wearing is almost a direct recreation of the suit from Batman the Animated Series. So I wonder if it's almost trying to, like, imply that it could be set in the same universe just, you know, several years down the road.
Well, I don't think that.
Which is not possible because they never did Jason Todd.
Right. And there's no indication that Tim Drake even exists. So.
And that's one thing I wanted to ask you about. I haven't read the story in so long, but I would have to assume that Tim Drake played some kind of role in that story, in the comic story. Right?
Oh, sure. Yeah, he's in the story. He's not a huge part of it. Honestly, Dick Grayson is a much bigger part of the story than Tim Drake is because Tim never knew Jason. The role that Tim plays is basically the less emotionally invested member of the Bat family, because in the book,
I would have the one that would draw the biggest emotional response from Jason, because he's the one that.
Yes. Jason. I wouldn't say he's antagonistic. Well, he is antagonistic. He basically says you're not worthy of wearing the uniform and stuff like that. And but I would say this: the movie, there's no way the movie could have fit Tim Drake in. There's just no way.
Right.
They had too much they were dealing with. They picked the right characters to focus on, and they also, and because of that, they were able to fit what feels like an incredibly complete story into this 72 minutes. Tim Drake is not here. Barbara, I don't believe, appears in this movie.
No.
Certainly not as Batgirl.
No. I don't even think Gordon appears in this
movie. No.
It's a very focused movie. I mean, it's you know, it's Tim. It's Jason. It's Dick. It's Bruce. And it's the Joker. And really, the four characters, and the Joker really even doesn't play a major role for the entire second act of the film. Like, he appears
this is the
here,
bit where, yeah.
And then they don't bring him in until they're getting ready to ramp up for the big third act again.
Which, again, this is an outstanding scene where they visit the Joker in Arkham, and he is he's the Joker. He's antagonizing them and mocking them, and they're of course being deadly serious because they're wanting to find who this new Red Hood is that's been basically going around and knocking off criminals, but stealing as well. And this is again speaks to the great Don DiMaggio in this role, because the one similarity with him and Hamill is they both do a good job of turning that switch between when they need to be light and whimsical, they can be light and whimsical, but when the time comes to turn that switch, they can turn up and be menacing. And there's the line that gets Batman over the top when he says, when he basically refers to Jason as being worm food. This is good stuff. And classic Batman joke, where Joker is basically daring him to kill him. He wants him to kill him. Reminiscent of the classic Dark Knight scene. Come on, I want you to do it.
If only David Sunday could have done that impression.
He's got one brewing. We need to get him on again. We need to get him on the show to talk about the Dark Knight. Oh, wouldn't that be great?
Come on, I want you to do it.
I just want my phone call.
Cowboy Joker.
We got to get his Southern Joker out to the masses, Nick.
Yep, Southern Joker.
And by the masses, I mean our dozens.
And dozens of fans. Yep. Right here on Place to Be Nation Pop.
That's right.
Right here on Place to Be Nation Cheap Pop. See what I did there?
That just made the list.
I did.
Okay, now, this is a good point for me to mention another aspect that I mentioned earlier on, that the Black Mask had become kind of the big Batman villain around this time in the comics. That's one thing that doesn't change. He is the big mob boss in Gotham in this movie. Like, he's kind of taken over all the gangs. He's the top dog in the food chain in the criminal underworld at this point. I will say this is the one thing, the only thing in the movie that I think is a little bit better in the book is Black Mask. Now, he's good here. He's entertaining as hell. He's just constantly, what would be the best way to describe him? Constantly just angry.
He's
furious about everything.
He strikes me as Al Pacino-esque is the best way I can put it. Like,
yes,
Al Pacino at his most, like, scent of a woman over the top, you know, like.
Yeah,
you can almost hear the hoo-ahs in his. In
Hoo-ah!
You know,
he's just perpetually at his with everyone around him.
And now I kind of want to see Al Pacino play Black Mask in a live action Batman movie.
Make it happen! Make it happen! Although he'd probably drop out halfway through. But in all seriousness, yes, that is very accurate, and that would be a great portrayal, by the way, Al Pacino as Black Mask. But in the comics, the best way I would liken him to during this storyline would be Hare Star from Preacher.
Where just everything because bad is happening to him?
Everything bad to him in this story. Like, every time he thinks he's got a leg up on either Batman or the Red Hood or Deathstroke, who he calls in to be an assassin for him, but then basically tells him to F off in the end. Everything bad happens to him. His office gets blown up. His assistant gets murdered.
He gets buggered.
His criminal... Say what?
He gets buggered.
He doesn't get buggered that I'm aware of. But, you know, he spends millions of dollars to bring in these hitmen that all fail. It's similar in this movie. In this movie, pretty much every plan he has goes awry because of the Red Hood and Batman. He's getting it from both sides, so to speak. And basically nothing is working out in his favor in this movie. Here, he reacts to it with anger. In the comic, he mainly reacts to it with just flabbergasted sarcasm. And his assistant is a big part of that, because his assistant is not like the typical comic book henchman that, yes, sir, boss. His henchmen in the comic actually just kind of like sarcastically replies to everything that he asks of him. But he's very good with calculation. So, but no, this, and again, great action scenes throughout this entire movie. Well animated. It's directed actually by Brandon Vietti. We haven't mentioned him yet. He is one of the minds, is Brandon Vietti, behind Young Justice, the classic DC animated show. He co-created it and co-produced it with Greg Wiseman.
And
so
currently yep. co-produces it because, as we have discussed in the past, it is returning for a third season.
And thank the Lord for that. That is
absolutely. And I guess that makes a lot of sense, though, Greg, because he wound up pulling from this film for his Batman, for Young Justice's Batman, because here, I believe, was the first time that Bruce Greenwood took on the voice role for the part. And I was struck. I've watched some Young Justice recently, and I was struck by the fact that this is not the Young Justice Batman. It's clear that Greenwood was kind of finding his way into the role, but you can hear, like, the hints of what he would eventually go with his full-time, you know, regular Batman voiceover on Young Justice. And I think it's, you know, it's certainly a performance that's in the works and it's in development, but you can see the building blocks of what winds up becoming a great Batman voice.
Yep. And by the way, Nightwing just saved Batman, just for the record. Nightwing just saved Batman. It does happen once in a blue moon. So that was good to see. But no, I agree with you. Bruce Greenwood, he's kind of finding his way, but no, I really liked his performance. Again, would I prefer Kevin Conroy in this role? Absolutely. I would prefer Kevin Conroy to always voice Batman. I would prefer Kevin Conroy to voice live-action Batman, if it were at all possible. But, you know, I will say this. Again, I think Bruce Greenwood is the second best voice of Batman that I've ever heard in these. He's just excellent. And even though I know that the new movies have their supporters, I honestly feel like the new movies would have been better off going with Bruce Greenwood as the voice of Batman rather than who voices Batman in these new movies?
I haven't seen one's Justice League War, so you're asking the wrong guy.
He's not bad at all. He's fine.
Is it Jason Mara?
Jason O'Mara. Jason O'Mara, yeah. Yeah. He's the guy. He's fine.
Yeah.
But again, and I didn't say this earlier, but you mentioned that this movie is kind of a standalone, not tied into other movies. I actually think that's to its benefit because I think that the DC movies they're still good, but I think they've lowered a little bit in quality since the decision to tie them all together. And I don't know if that's because they're tied together, but I do think that it's probably just coincidental that, to me, the highest quality DC animated movies took place before the quote-unquote merger.
Well, because they felt free to adapt whatever they wanted, and I think now they're trying to pull largely from modern storytelling, for the most part anyway, for that series of ongoing films. Now, clearly you still get stuff like The Killing Joke, which is firmly set outside the continuity of anything, really. But for those, you know, those that are set in that one narrative, I think they feel constrained by not being able to go back into the character's catalog and pull from the classics, so to speak.
Right, absolutely. And that's I definitely think that's a part of it. And I think that this movie and the others around it demonstrates a better job of kind of navigating the limited runtime. And right now you see they've already – think about how early we are in this movie, Nick, and how much they've already given us, how much they've already
– Yep.
We've already seen the death of Robin. We've already seen Red Hood debut on the scene. We've already seen Batman and Nightwing take out Amazo. Batman and Nightwing visit the Joker in jail. Now Red Hood having his first encounter with Batman and Nightwing. All of this in the quarter of the movie, half of the first movie.
We're probably nearing the halfway point. I'm not really positive.
I mean, that is a movie's worth of action in many events, and it doesn't feel rushed.
Yeah,
at least in my opinion.
Absolutely. Yeah, no. It doesn't feel rushed. Now, this is the scene we're about to get where Batman is going to kind of put two and two together. Now, I did not read the comic story as it was being released, so I don't know if that story really surprised people the way that something like, say, the Winter Soldier did for Captain America fans. But this kind of does. This film does the same thing that the Winter Soldier live-action film did for Captain America, where it kind of pretty much telegraphs up front what the character is and what the twist is. Was that the case in the comics?
So, yep.
Because you were reading, month by month at the time, right?
Yeah. Yes and no. Here's the deal. Everybody kind of knew after Hush that they were going to bring Jason Todd back, even though there was some question, there's still some question over whether Loeb and Lee ever intended to actually bring Jason back. DC was going to do it because they saw how the reaction was to that. So everybody at the time kind of knew that that was in the works. I think the kind of question came in of would pull the trigger, because they teased us in Hush and they showed Jason coming back, ended up being Clayface. So in this story, what you see is, they kind of did the same thing. They telegraphed it up front. Red Hood flat out tells Bruce, you know who I am, you just want it. And Bruce still doesn't want to believe it. He wants to believe that it's Clayface again. He goes through all these options. And it almost made it, if this makes sense, Nick, it almost made it where it was so obvious that you thought they'd pull a switcheroo on you,
Yeah.
And it kind of felt like they were setting up to swerve you.
A swerve, yeah. Or a twist, if you will.
Swerve. A twist. And as it turns out, the biggest swerve of all was not doing a swerve. Mm-hmm. Especially at that time in comics, which were big on swerves.
Right.
And so it's – I would say that the question, it was never intended to really be a swerve. They set it up intentionally to, lead you to believe that it was going to be Jason. And even in the promotion to the sewer, they said, hey, this is Return of Jason Todd. But there was still that lingering doubt of would they actually have the guts to pull the trigger on this. Because once you pull the trigger on bringing him back, you can't put the genie back in the bottle.
And you got to have a plan for him going forward, which many would argue they kind of didn't.
They didn't, yeah. I would only argue that they did not have a plan past that initial story arc. But nevertheless, this movie intentionally makes the decision to tell you straight up who the Red Hood is, essentially. I mean, they don't tell you, but you know.
Well, transition directly from the death of Robin into the introduction of the Red Hood with a 5 years later little tag or whatever. So, no mystery.
And I will say this. Another nice little bit there is how Bruce puts it all together.
Right.
Where he figured out Jason's fighting style and remembered it from how he trained him. That's great, because one of the big risks with Under the Red Hood is you run the risk of almost taking away from how smart Batman is if he can't figure it out. Mm-hmm. And in the comic, the way they approach that is that it's blatantly obvious, and they make it clear that he knows, he just doesn't want to admit it. He's grasping at straws to try to prove why it's not true. And here, they don't really do that, but they do a good job of maybe a little bit more subtly showing how Bruce, even when he figures it out, he just does not want it true. He runs the tests over and over and over again, has no choice but to accept it. And it's good voice acting from Bruce Greenwood, great voice acting from Neil Patrick Harris as Nightwing. We have not mentioned Jensen Ackles as the Red Hood, who's excellent here. Mm-hmm. He has that edginess and grittiness that you want out of Jason Todd. This is a guy that's bitter. He's bitter at Batman, not for letting him die, as we find out later in the film. He's bitter at Batman for letting the Joker live. And he's angry, legitimately angry. And he's angry at everything that's happened to him. He's also been driven a little mad by the Lazarus Pit.
And won't admit that he's been driven mad by the Lazarus Pit?
Yep. Which is a key aspect of any great villain, right?
Yep.
They don't acknowledge their flaws, and which that's another story for another time about how DC wasted a chance to have Jason Todd become the next great villain. But we can touch on that perhaps at another time, because the building blocks were there. Let's just say that.
At the very least, build something that someone wasn't going to be just another member of the Bat family, which is what he's kind of become in recent years.
Right. You could have done a redemption arc for him, really.
Eventually.
But it feels like they never really did.
No, they just kind of, he just randomly turned at some point. It just, it never felt built to. It never felt like his beef with Batman had a real resolution to it. He easily could have been the ultimate tweener, you know, for a long time. And for whatever reason, they chose not to go that route. I guess the closest they came was when they did Battle for the Cowl, and he was very clearly at odds with all the other Robins. Because he was using the Batman suit to kill and do things that they believe that the mantle should stand for. But that was a three-issue story that, by and large, has been forgotten by a lot of people, I would argue.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, maybe it's a bit much to say this, but it felt like he could have played the role that Deathstroke plays now. Mm-hmm. Of a kind of anti-hero character that operates, you know, he's got a moral code. But because of his moral code, he's never going to be on the same side as the heroes.
Right. The analogy we've always used is they should have made him DC's version of the Punisher. Like, technically a hero, but only in the sense of he kills the bad guys, you know? He could have filled a role.
The concept.
Right.
The concept of him should have been the same as the Punisher, in that if the Punisher walks into a room with Captain America, Captain America is going to try to arrest the Punisher.
Right.
And that should be the situation with Red Hood and, say, Superman, for instance.
Yep.
Instead, the fact that Red Hood constantly hangs around Superman's best buddy Batman kind of, you know, sits at odds with that. But nevertheless, I also – one of the other things I love about this movie is the way they interlay the backstory of Jason and Batman. You know what I mean? How they show these flashbacks occasionally that will show Jason as Robin, or even Jason trying to steal the wheels off the Batmobile, which really establishes the difference between Jason and Dick. Always the good soldier, always the good, you know, the loyal, you know, good boy, basically. He was always good-natured. Jason was not. Jason grew up on the streets. And, again, we get to see more and more of what led Jason. That Jason was already a little unhinged before he ever went in the Lazarus Pit. And it's no secret why, after going in the pit, now he's really, really unhinged.
Yep. Cool fight scene going here with, who are these characters again?
I wish I could tell you, but my stream is, messed up. Oh gosh, what are their names? Terrible Trio or something like that. They're a group of basically a for hire that...
The Frightful Four? Wait a minute, that's...
Black Mask.
No, that's the other one.
Perhaps the Frightful... No. Yeah, I think this is the, something... They're a group of assassins, basically, that uses them instead of Deathstroke.
Okay, gotcha.
They may actually appear in the comic. I can't remember. But I distinctly remember the big, like, assassin that gets called in by Black Mask is Deathstroke. Although, Deathstroke basically turns him down. When it comes down to it, because Deathstroke said he doesn't have anything to gain. This is while the secret society was being formed, leading into Infinite Crisis, if you recall.
Yep.
So they go there and basically are negotiating with Black Mask. He said he wants Red Hood dead. Ends up not happening. Things fall apart from there.
Oof.
But
Red Hood just blew one of their brains out, so...
Batman
is not Batman reacting.
None too happy about that.
Yeah, not reacting well to that. So, you get the first sense here of what the philosophical divide is between the two, even though it's pretty clearly just a mask for Jason, you know, Jason's misplaced aggression over the way Bruce handled his death, I would think.
Yes, I would agree with that for sure. Primarily, and it's hard to necessarily... I mean, you can disagree with his methods, but Jason kind of has a point, doesn't he? Or maybe he doesn't. Maybe I'm nuts. But I kind of feel like Jason has a point about, at least has a reason to be upset. I don't know that he handles it the right way, but I think that most people could understand that if you came back and you realized that no one came to punish the guy that
is a bit much. I mean, Batman clearly at some point apprehended the Joker and put him back where he belongs. So to say he didn't do anything is a bit of a stretch, I would
say. That's true. That's fair. Yeah, that's fair. But I get the point you made that the Joker has. Now, in fairness, we're not sure. Maybe in this movie, he's been locked up ever since he killed Robin. But certainly, going by the history of Batman-Joker confrontations, you would have to assume that at some point he escaped. And if that's the case, he probably killed other people. And round we go.
And there's a line there's a line near the end where Jason is saying something to the effect of, you know, think about all the things he's done, the people he's killed, he's crippled, which pretty much, you know,
which
heavily implies that
that's definitely an illusion.
Yeah, the killing joke happened in the backstory of this film. So that's interesting if you want to view it that way.
No, I definitely view it that way. I think that's
pretty clear that 100%
intentional.
Pretty clear that Judd Winnick must have been a big fan of the Alan Moore Batman stuff between, you know, incorporating the Killing Joke backstory origin and also incorporating the that line about the potential fate of Barbara Gordon.
Right, and so one of the things also that we've talked about already are the changes from the comic. I'll talk a little bit more about why I feel like this is an improvement on the comic. Again, I've mentioned that I like the comic a lot. It's really good. But by and large, I think – and part of me wonders if more writers would like to get do-overs like this. Because anybody that's ever written creatively, you're almost never satisfied with what you've done.
Yeah, just ask
– rarely do
just
I –
just ask George Lucas, for God's sake.
And so – but unlike George Lucas – in this case, the changes that Winnick was able to make his own story helped the narrative. Ra's al Ghul makes a lot more sense as the facilitator of Jason's return than did Superboy Prime. Ra's, even the reasoning that they give for doing it, that he felt so much guilt for hiring the Joker in the first place when the Joker killed Robin, that he did this out of guilt to try and bring Jason back to life, only to realize the horrible consequences of it after the fact.
Yeah, basically trying to rectify his own
mistake. That was a great addition.
Yep, I agree.
Yeah.
Shows that Ra's does have some code of honor and a level of respect for Batman that has always been there when the best writers write that dynamic, but something that can easily be lost.
Yep.
So good to see they maintain that. And let's be honest, like, this, from a character standpoint and from a just a general... You know, just from a general narrative plot standpoint, it's easier to wrap your head around the pre-existing idea of the Lazarus Pit coming into play than it is the admittedly somewhat convoluted and, quote, cause comics reasoning of Superboy Prime punching a hole in reality. It just improves the story in almost every way, I would argue.
I would agree. And the one way they might have been able to make it better is if they had created a hole in forever in this movie.
Ah, yes. And defeat, you know, at the end they all sing some sort of bizarre melody to defeat the evildoers.
Batman defeating the Red Hood by singing to him truly would have been a, oh, what's the term for it? Some unique situation, quite frankly.
Quite frankly.
But no, so that's among the changes. Also, there is visual imagery, the themes of this one are apparent throughout through some of the visual cues, and primarily it pays off in the epilogue of this movie, which to me is one of the most touching epilogues in any animated movie that I've seen. It gets me every single time, and we'll touch on that maybe a little bit later, but it's, you know, the scene I'm referring to, I think, Nick, with the case with the Robin costume in it at the very end. Mm-hmm. And a line of dialogue that Bruce says to Alfred that just blows me away.
Well, even then, like right now, we're about to get a visual callback because here's Bruce digging up Jason's grave. And you see at one point him prying open the casket with a crowbar. And they intentionally focus in on the crowbar as it drops to the ground the same way they did the shot of the crowbar dropping to the ground after Joker had just beaten Jason to death. And then they do it again when the crowbar comes into play during the final scene with Batman, Jason, and the Joker later on. So, nice visual callbacks there.
Certainly so. And, again, we see, you know, the unhinged nature of so many of the people in this story. Red Hood is unhinged. Joker is unhinged. Black Mask is clearly unhinged. It's very interesting to watch. And then you've got Batman, who you could make a strong argument is unhinged. So you've got these highly emotional players kind of doing battle with one another, intellectually, physically, and otherwise. And it creates this just compelling dynamic. The action never slows down. Even when there's not a fight scene or when there's not anything quote-unquote happening, there's stuff happening. I mean, that it happened early on in the movie, but the scene at Arkham may be the second best interrogation movie or interrogation scene in a Batman movie after, of course, the Dark Knight interrogation scene.
Yep.
Just really well-paced. He's so good at capturing the pace. And again, I'm just reading the dialogue. The script is tight. The dialogue is tight. It just clips along. And when we say that this is the best of the DC movies, we're not knocking stuff like Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, Emerald Knights, which is a close, close number two for me.
Well, Mask of the Phantasm is probably still my number two. And I think it's razor thin between this one and Mask of the Phantasm, which I think, just because it's been around so long, I think people have forgotten just how good it is.
Right, right. No, Mask of the Phantasm is great, too. I think Emerald Knights, for me, is more of a personal love project because it's, you know, it may be the Green Lantern movie we ever get. Let's be honest.
Probably will be the best Green Lantern movie we ever get.
And then, of course, Justice League New Frontier, which is phenomenal. So they've made a lot of five-star movies is what we're getting at. But this, it just works on so many levels because it's harder inherently for animation to draw that emotional guttural reaction out of you because you don't see – if you see a real person emoting, it's more likely to create empathy. But this movie does a better job than any of the comic book animated movies and honestly probably up there with the Pixar movies for creating an emotional feeling when you see these characters – go through what they go through, whether it's Batman going through his loss, Jason, that scene when he confronts Batman at the end of the movie and he says, Cobblepot, not Dent, this guy. And I thought you would do it because of me, you know? Like, that pain that you get there, it's a combination of incredible voice acting, great, great animation, and, again, a wonderful script that you know, again, Judd Winnick had a chance to go over his story, keep what worked, drop what didn't, and add in stuff to make it better. And he did all of that.
Yep. And here we're going to get the scene where Ra's is going to reveal, you know, fill in the gaps for Batman of what happened in between what we saw in the prologue of the movie and what led up to this event. It's basically the backstory of how Jason has returned to life. He's going to reveal that entire series of events, as well as his initial role in what happened there in that prologue. So this is, you know, we've been talking about changes to the story. This is probably, this scene here is unquestionably, I would think, the biggest of those changes.
Right, no question about that. And again, it's a change for the better. It's a change that makes a lot more sense, honestly, than what you see in the comic. It doesn't rely on another story, whereas in the comics, they actually refer directly to Hush, and they end up saying that it was Jason, and he switched places with Clayface, which, you know, I could take or leave that, to be honest. But this movie is not tied to anything else. It's not beholden to continuity the way that the comic was. And because of that, it just feels more emotionally satisfying. Not that the comic didn't, but this is just to a different level. And we didn't talk about it, but the scene with the Joker and Black Mask confronting each other, how great was that?
Awesome scene, yep. Yep.
It also establishes to me the hierarchy of Gotham villains in that it's pretty clear that if the Joker wanted to, he could eliminate Black Mask anytime he wanted to. But he doesn't want to. He has no reason to. He thrives on chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And Black Mask represents an interesting player on the board, so to speak, for him. I'm using a lot of video game analogies here, I feel, but hey, if the shoe fits.
Indeed.
But yeah, so when you're looking at the DC animated, Warner Brother animated output, what about this one to you, Nick, that kind of gives it a little bit of an edge over the rest of the field.
It's that pacing. I mean, that's usually, you know, like I said earlier, the animation is almost always of a very high quality. The voice acting is almost always excellent. And so what it comes down to is which of these movies are the best paced. And I think this one does the best of managing that 72-minute format of fitting in enough but not making it feel rushed in any way. And that's really what I'm looking for whenever I watch these movies. I hate when I feel like they're tackling too much or that something hasn't been, you know, various plot points haven't been given enough time to truly develop. So this one, to me, takes the things placed upon it and almost uses them to its benefit. So
yep.
for me, that's probably it. And plus, I mean, as I've said about Arrow before, you know, Arrow is something that is right in my wheelhouse, or my wheelhouse, so to speak.
Quite frankly.
And so, Well Done Arrow is something I'm always going to enjoy more than something like Well Done Flash. And so, Batman is kind of the same way. Batman is my favorite character in all of comics. So, a Well Done Batman flick is always going to get the nod over something like, even something as well done as Justice League New Frontier.
Right. And, well, kind of along those lines, what is it? I mean, we've seen other good Batman adaptations. Year One was good. Dark Knight Returns was good. What is it about this one that kind of gives it even a leg up over those?
Well, Dark Knight Returns and Year One are largely, for the most part, you know, you have minor differences here and there, but they are stories that directly adapt their source material, whereas this one takes inspiration, heavy inspiration from its source material, but like you said, it finds ways to improve the source material in ways that those films do not. Like, I'm going to be honest, if I want to experience Year One or The Dark Knight Returns and my choices between, you know, reading the book or film, I'm almost always going to opt for, you know, actually picking up the book and reading it. Unlike Under the Hood, or in this case, Under the Red Hood, where I genuinely believe the film is the superior version of the story.
Right, and I agree with that. I think this is a case of taking something and, you know, often when we see a good movie or a good TV show, the go-to response is always, yeah, but the book's better. Or even in our world, yeah, the comic's better. And a lot of times it is, but this is, isn't. And
the very rare instance where it's not, yes.
Right. And this is to the credit of everyone involved in making this. It's much, much akin to when we heap praise upon Justice League Unlimited. Because I can honestly say, without reservation, that Justice League and Justice League Unlimited, the cartoon, is better than any Justice League comic I've ever read, and that's how high of esteem I hold it in, and I hold this movie in that kind of esteem. Because really, like you said, Nick, do you watch one of these movies and you think, well, the story that it's inspired by is honestly not quite as good as this.
Yep.
This is probably the only time I can remember that happening with these. Even with something like Green Lantern Emerald Knights. It's a hodgepodge of great Green Lantern stories that are all, you know, if you read them on their own, probably better than what you get in the movie. The movie's great because it ties them all together. But everything about this works. The voice cast works. And look, I know it's expensive, I'm sure, to get these guys. They're all busy. They all have big projects. Man, I would love to see this voice cast come back. Like, whenever we get a Nightwing, you know, God willing, one day, if we ever get a Nightwing animated movie or Titans animated movie, I want Neil Patrick Harris to voice Nightwing. And I know it's probably not going to happen. But I want that to happen. And I want Jensen Ackles to do the voice of Red Hood if we ever see him again. And hell, I would take Bruce Greenwood as Batman. Nothing against Jason O'Mara. He's fine. But I would love a Bruce Greenwood take on him again. But primarily, Neil Patrick Harris was just so good. And I'll be honest, I know he's a little bit older than you would want for Dick Grayson and may not be able to get himself in Dick Grayson-level shape, but I wouldn't mind Neil Patrick Harris playing him in live action, to be honest with you, especially if it was an older Nightwing, since they've got an older Batman in
that
the...
That is an exceptionally odd choice for Nightwing live action casting, Greg.
I'm just saying, man, I think he could pull it off. It would be very weird, but listen,
It's hard buying Nikita as an action badass at this point in his career, I think. But,
well,
you know.
Probably. But I don't think people could have bought him as his How I Met Your Mother character played that one either.
That's true. And much like his How I Met Your Mother character, Nightwing's philandering ways would probably come across, which is good.
That's very true. Dick and Barney do have some things in common.
Yes.
Not all. I don't think Dick Grayson is quite as much of a well Dick as Barney is, but they do have some things in common. I'm not saying that would be like dream casting necessarily. I'm saying I wouldn't mind it. I think it would be cool to see. It has no chance of ever happening, but certainly in animated form, he proved in this movie that, I mean, to me, he gets it. He gets how to voice Dick and have that mix of humor, compassion, and when needed, grit. And Jensen Ackles, phenomenal. I mean, I feel like we've gone through the entire voice cast at this point. Ra's al Ghul, I don't even know who voiced him, but awesome.
Jason Isaacs, yeah.
Oh, perfect. We've taught that recently about how it's just, even though I don't really know what Ra's origin is, his national origin, it just sounds right for him to have that kind of British royal accent, if that makes sense.
Like the guy who played him on Arrow was great, I thought. Liam Neeson, of course, was perfect.
Liam Neeson, the Arrow guy. Matt Nable, I think, was his name.
Which is weird that Liam Neeson's British or Scottish accent gave way to his daughter having a French accent, but that's neither here nor there.
Well, quite frankly. And, of course, the guy in the animated series was wonderful, too. I don't know what his name was either.
Yeah. Been a long spectacular time, though. And then I heard that in one of the recent animated films that Giancarlo Esposito from Breaking Bad did the voice. So that's interesting. I would like to see that at some point.
Yeah. I have not been able to see many of the latest Warner animated offerings.
He would have been in whichever one introduced Damian. So what was it, Batman? And
Son of Batman.
Son of Batman, yeah.
Yeah, Son of Batman. And I only watched a little bit of that. I honestly don't remember much about Ra's in the bit that I watched. This is certainly on a very short list. Even if it's not necessarily someone's top pick in the animated world, it's got to be in the top five area. Because to me, it doesn't get much better than this for Batman movies. So what would be your top five off the top of your head of the – let's stick in the WB animation era, which would be starting with – Superman Doomsday in 2005.
So not counting Mask of the Sub-Zero, that era.
Right.
Oh man. So let's see. So that would rule out a Return of the Joker as well. So, top five. We'll go this at number one. We'll go New Frontier at two. Emerald Knights B. Dark Knight Returns, and I'm going to count it as one film at four, and then, what would be that fifth spot? I'd have to think on that one. It would either be Year One, or what did they call the loosely adapted Justice League movie they pulled from Tower of Babel?
Oh, that was Justice League Doom.
Justice League Doom, yeah. No, excuse me. Let me change that fifth spot. Change that to Flashpoint Paradox.
Oh, that's a good one, yeah.
So, yeah, I'll go this. I'll go New Frontier, Emerald Knights, Dark Knight Returns, and Paradox.
Very good, very good. Okay, with me, I am going to go at the top. I'll take this one. At number two, Emerald Knights. At number three, New Frontier. At number four, Wonder Woman. And at number five, ooh, that's a tough one. There's so many good choices here. Give me Superman, Batman, Apocalypse.
I'm stunned you're not going Public Enemies over Apocalypse, but.
I love Public Enemies, but I think that's a case where they made a couple changes in the movie that weren't as good as the book.
Right.
In terms of what they had to cut out.
And then I would throw a shout out to, what was it, Crisis on Two Earths that had James Woods as Owlman?
Yeah, Crisis on Two Earths. Public Enemies was very, very good,
too. Public Enemies was great.
Justice League Doom, amazing. Like I said earlier. Has one of the best Green Lantern scenes.
Year One is very good as well. I know a lot of people were down on it for whatever reason, but I liked it.
I think I am controversial in my thoughts that Year One is a better animated adaptation than Dark Knight Returns.
No, I don't agree with that. But that's
it's hard to say. I mean, it's tough. It's tough. Dark Knight Returns too, but I kind of fell in love with the Jim Gordon. Bryan Cranston
as Jim Gordon? Yes, but I'll see your Bryan Cranston and counter you with Peter freaking Weller as Batman.
Good point. All right, maybe I'll rewatch those and reconsider. But when you look at it, I mean they've really put out
they had a stretch run there for about like 8 years where it felt like they just couldn't do anything wrong. And
no, it Superman vs. Heat was really good. I'm sure you haven't seen that one. It's very, very good.
Never saw the All-Star Superman adaptation they did either.
I didn't like All-Star Superman as an adaptation, personally.
I didn't like All-Star Superman as a story, but...
Superman Unbound, which is the adaptation of the Brainiac story by Jeff Johns and Gary Frank. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Justice League, Flashpoint Paradox was good. My only deal with Flashpoint Paradox that holds it back for me, the story's great, the voice acting's great. The animation style is still kind of weird to me.
That weird anime-inspired, or that was kind of the beginning of their transition to it, so I can understand that, but a animated version of that damn letter scene at the end of the film just kind of...
Yeah, very, very good. Justice League War was good. Throne of Atlantis was really good.
Did you see that? Throne of Atlantis.
Not as good as the book, but
Justice League War was the last one I saw, and that was...
I'll tell you the one you got to see is Assault on Arkham. A good Suicide Squad movie.
I've heard that, and I'm surprised that, you know, that was by and then just never did because it was supposed to be loosely tied into the video game universe, so.
Yeah, and it's really good. Like, it's what the Suicide Squad movie should have been.
Right.
But we digress. So, all that being said, any final thoughts on Batman Under the Red Hood as we comes to wrapping up here?
It's excellent, and if you haven't seen it, you should watch it, and if you have seen it and don't own it, you should own it.
Yep, and right now it's actually streaming on HBO. If you have the HBO Go or HBO apps, and they actually work for you, mine is hit or miss. Then definitely check out the movie and give it a watch if you've never seen it before. It's amazing. And I want to talk a little bit about that epilogue scene that I referenced earlier. Basically, we get to the end of the movie. Red Hood is. Correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, because I might be conflating the book with the movie. Red Hood is missing, and
they're
not really sure where he's at the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. And at the end, Batman's in the cave. Alfred, I believe, is at the glass chamber that was holding the Robin costume. And Alfred and Bruce are having this heart-to-heart, and Alfred says something to the effect of, I'm assuming that with everything that's happened, we'll want to take this away. We want to take this down and put it away. And then Bruce says no, and he walks right by it, and he says, this changes absolutely nothing. And he walks off, and that's kind of the last line that you're left with. And then there's this little shot of Jason when he was Robin with this big grin on his face as he and Batman are kind of swinging through Gotham. And it's just, for me, as a longtime fan of the characters, it was like an unexpected moment the first time I saw it, and it really was like a punch to the gut. Like, it was legitimately an emotional moment for me watching it. Like, I did not see it coming, and I thought it was beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. Probably didn't hit me quite as hard as it did you, but I can certainly agree with that, yeah.
So, yeah, just a great example of what you can do with this medium, and in some ways, I've always thought that animation is a better comic book films than live action. It's just you're never going to get the budget for an animated movie that you're going to get for a live action movie, obviously. So, really, really cool stuff. Anyway, with all that being said, we're going to finish things up here. When you come back on the other side, we're going to have read and watching. We're going to have the rundown, and we may even have an update. I don't know. I mean, Nick, as you know, we don't know when these are going to come, if they're even going to come.
Right, right. Yep.
We may get an update on a WWE superstar and his employment status.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But we don't know. We may not get it this week. This might be the week when we just don't know. But stay with us through the break and find out if a certain individual is employed or no longer employed.
We'll return after these messages. Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And, of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage wall pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place of the Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
Now back to the show. On Nick.
When your single doubts,
welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the second half.
Oh, that would be hard traveling, fanboys. Probably not actually the second half. We're probably in the back quarter here. But we are going to lead things off here in the back half of the show, back into the show, with a little segment called
Welcome to the
You hear it, folks. And with that being said, let's get cracking with the biggest news and notes in the week of comics. And we're going to start off with an area of comic book film that we don't talk about that often, and that's the X-Men universe. And in some upheaval with talk of Bryan Singer leaving the helm of the ship of the X-Men universe and Deadpool kind of taking prominence over the franchise. But Sophie Turner, who played as Jean Grey in the X-Men Apocalypse film last year, recently said that she is shooting an X-Men sequel this summer, despite the fact that the X-Men sequel hasn't been formally announced yet. She said they're about it. She's just finished shooting season 7 of Game of Thrones, and she's got a couple more movies to do before X-Men starts.
Then she'll go right from that into season 8 of Game of Thrones. Now the talk is that there'll be the start of the Dark Phoenix saga.
Start of the Dark Phoenix saga, considering we've already seen a very shitty adaptation of the Dark Phoenix saga
extremely,
in live action.
Yes, an extremely truncated, not good version of the Dark Phoenix saga we saw in X-Men 3, The Last Stand. Mm-hmm. Nick, your thoughts on this whole deal?
It's interesting, considering everything I had read about this project previously indicated that Bryan Singer was planning on stepping away. And so if Bryan Singer is planning on stepping away, that means you need a director. And if that means you need a director, how can you possibly be planning on filming in a few months if no director has been put in place to set a shooting? So either she's talking out of her ass, or this thing is in development a lot further along than we thought. I know that Fox has reserved a few key dates. I believe one is in March of 2018, another in November of 2018, and the final one is February 2018 over the next couple of years for three projected X-Men releases. Now, the February one is, I believe, confirmed, February of 19 one, I should say, is confirmed the 2 release date, which leaves both of next year's, both of the 2018 release dates unfilled. The X-Men project we've heard more about recently is actually the New Mutants project that I'm assuming will fill one of those roles. So, perhaps this is going to happen. Perhaps it's like she says for that late 2018 release. But I find it hard to believe considering we haven't heard anything else about it.
Is it possible that Jean Grey is going to appear in the New Mutants movie and that's the X-Men movie she's referring to?
Based on what I have read about the New Mutants movie, is the idea of New Mutants is to literally be that, an entirely new group of mutants, not related to the main, the core group that we've seen in the X-Men films up to this point. Now, I could be wrong about that, but what I believe I read was that was going to focus on an entirely new group of characters.
Right, but I'm saying perhaps she makes a cameo, because it is going to be tied into the X-Men. They're probably going to be at the end in some...
Yeah, that's true. I mean, but if it's just a cameo, would she really be needing to clear her schedule and talk about, you know, big plans for later this year? I don't know. The whole thing is just very weird, because it seems kind of out of left field, and even Fox themselves, you know, who are typically pretty quick to announce films that they think are going to get them some good, haven't really said much about this one.
And the other thing that concerns me is, I wouldn't say concerns me, but I will say this. The Dark Phoenix saga in particular is, that I read very carefully if they're going to tell that story, because there's a lot of story there to tell. And they have to make sure that they don't have to hit every beat from the comic. Well, they do need to hit the beats. They don't need to like completely replicate the comic, but they need to make sure that they've only given us one movie of this Grey. Remember that. There was, what, 18, 19 years, or probably not that much. There was probably, like, 17 years or so of Jean Grey in the comics before they ever got to the Dark Phoenix saga. So there was all these years of fans being to connect to Jean.
And I think it's important to remember it's a Jean Grey that doesn't really have a romantic relationship with Scott Summers at this point, which is kind of one of the main emotional through points of the Dark Phoenix saga. So I almost wish they would do... it sounds weird to say, but just another X-Men movie before Dark Phoenix Saga, just to give the characters more time to evolve and for us to become, you know, attached to these versions of the characters.
Yes. Well, from a movie, one unit movie universe that has a lot of question marks surrounding it to another movie universe that has a lot of question marks surrounding it. And let's move over to the always controversial, somewhat unique DC extended universe.
Yes.
Because Nick, do you want to tackle the Batman's your guy? So do you want to tackle the latest reports out there regarding the director of the new Batman, and even its star?
Sure. Why not? I mean, it wouldn't be an episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys or an edition of the Rundown without your weekly look at the somewhat unique production status of The Batman, the long-rumored, at one time to be written, produced, and directed by Ben Affleck, standalone Batman movie set in the DCEU. And, you know, on last week's show, we talked about that rumored shortlist of directors that was out there. We kind of ranked our choice. Well, a report came out this past week that, or several reports from pretty much all the major Hollywood publications came out that the director of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and War for Planet of the Apes, director Matt Reeves, has been offered the job as director of the Batman. Now, all those reports indicate he has the offer in hand, but it says that Warner Brothers is still considering a couple of directors as backup options if Reeves turns the job down, but most are expecting that to happen at this point. So everything seems to indicate that Matt Reeves will be the director of the Batman. Now, who will he be directing Batman is the much more interesting report, because as has been rumored for a while, there were reports this past week that, you know, Ben Affleck's involvement with the Batman has kind of been gradually deteriorating over the last 6 to 8 months. From, you know, it went from he was going to write, produce, direct, and star in the Batman to now he's only going to produce and star in it, less credit on the initial script or what have you. And now there are reports that Ben Affleck is seeking to depart the film altogether. Greg, just last week, we talked about how it wouldn't surprise us at this point, and I know we don't want to, you know, instantly assume that this is the case, but literally, Greg, every negative rumor about this film, as it pertains to Ben Affleck, has turned out to be true at this point. So what are we supposed to make of this potential report?
First of all, I'll preface this that actually went directly to the source. I actually watched the Collider video that is the source of this report. That is a kind of a roundtable movie discussion, and the guy that started it, John Campea, I think is his name. Mm-hmm. He said his own words are that take this with a massive grain of salt.
Okay.
He says that he's talked to three different people that are close to the project, and all three of them told him that Affleck is trying to get out of the project entirely, that he is in active talks with Warner Brothers to try and get out of the contract. But the ball is in Warner Brothers' court. If they force him to do the movie, he will then do this movie, and then he'll be gone. He'll be gone after he's fulfilled his contractual obligations, which would be the Batman, presumably, and Justice League 2. He said that the sources told him that Ben, if he had his wishes and everything worked out the way he wanted to, would walk off of the project right now and not do any of these. But he said again, the guy says, I've been wrong on this before. I got burned on a rumor a couple years ago on a different movie. He said, there's no guarantee of any of this. He said, I hope it's not true. But he said, I'm just letting you guys know what I've been told. So that's the disclaimer out of the way. Even the guys that said it did not say it as firmly as a lot of the sites reporting on it are making it out to be.
True, but we have heard this rumbling has been out there. Alluded to in the Forbes piece that we talked about last week.
The Forbes piece alluded to it as well. He said that he had heard similar rumblings in the article that came before the most recent Forbes piece about Batman. So, yeah, and so if let's take the worst case scenario, which I think would be a worst case scenario, and let's assume this is true, there's no way that this wouldn't be considered a huge blow. Is there? I mean, that's the one element of Batman versus Superman, or Batman v Superman, that everyone was in agreement on.
No, it's the one element of the DC Extended Universe, because you got to remember, Man of Steel, incredibly divisive amongst fans. The only, fans and critics alike, the only aspect of the universe to this point that has been generally well accepted is Ben Affleck's Batman.
Yep. And to lose Affleck, I'll be honest. I thought this is just me being completely honest here. I think it was a bigger loss to lose Affleck as a director than lose him as a star.
From a practical standpoint, you're probably right. But you got to understand, everything at this point is also a public relations battle they're fighting. And to lose Affleck altogether, I think, is a bigger public relations blow and a blow to the reputation of the DC films than it was to lose Affleck just as a director.
And look, there's going to be no shortage of actors that would line up to play Batman. But
Affleck did it really well. He had seemed to have a handle on the character, how to do the brooding and all of that stuff. I probably won't go as far as a lot of people have to say that he is the best Batman that we've seen. I don't necessarily believe that, but I think that he did a really good job in Batman v Superman, and I was really excited to see where it went from there. He's clearly very talented, is a fan of the character, which I think it really helps a lot. But, you know, it is a PR battle. This would be a huge PR hit to them, would add fuel to all the critics that they've had as well.
Especially because this wouldn't be taking place in a vacuum. It would go on to the news of, along with the other news of, you know, him stepping away as director initially, the competing cuts of Suicide Squad that were allegedly out there,
the
directorial issues with The Flash, the issues with the Batman script, the troubled production of various other DC films. It becomes another bucket of that general sense that Warner Brothers doesn't seem to have a true direction for this line of films at this point.
Yeah, and you know, and maybe this is all still part of the cleaning house project of maybe this is – do you get the impression that maybe this could – I don't want to – I hate – hell, I don't hate it that much. Let's call this Speculator's Corner here, or I think that's already taken actually. Let's call this baseless speculation time, and we're – is it possible that DC or Warner's doesn't have faith in Justice League and they are already anticipating that Justice League is going to fail?
Why would Affleck want out already if after only doing Batman v Superman, and granted the film itself was not responded to the way he wanted, but his portrayal was generally well accepted?
Yeah.
I have a bad feeling that he must know something about Justice League that nobody else knows at this point.
I haven't voiced it on this show yet because I don't want to be – I generally – you know me, man. I thrive on positivity. I believe we need to be positive about the industry. But and I really hate to say this. I honestly do because I don't want to come off as a guy that's negative towards Zack Snyder because I like most of his movies. I have had a bad feeling about Justice League for a while, and I hope I'm wrong. But I can't lie. My gut feeling on Wonder Woman is that it's going to be a good – safe movie, and that's my gut feeling on it. It's going to be good. I may be wrong on that, but I think it'll be good. My gut feeling on Justice League, pretty much since production started, has been that it has potential to be a big disaster. And I hope I'm wrong on that, but I just, even the still images and stuff, they really haven't done much to excite me.
I have maintained since the beginning that I'm not saying it's impossible to do, but doesn't it seem like the vision of the DC universe that Zack Snyder has and the vision that Geoff Johns has are
too much at odds?
Are too much at odds to make a cohesive film? Let me make the comparison of what happened to the Batman franchise in the wake of Batman Returns, where Warner's wanted to keep Tim Burton on as a creative influence while transitioning control of the franchise over to a new director, and what we got was a weird, mishmashed hodgepodge of two completely, you know, drastically different styles, and it resulted in my opinion, the worst Batman film of all time. And I just wonder if, from Jeff's perspective at this point, you know, it's almost like in sports when there are some people who take over a franchise, coaches or general managers or what have you, who can come in and take a franchise and make tweaks, you know, and be successful. But there are others who come in and need to completely clean house, to tear the thing down and start all over. And I wonder if perhaps the foundation that has been built for the DC Extended Universe is just too different at this point from what Jeff wants, if it might not be better for him to be allowed to build from the ground up. But then you run into the issue of,
yep,
would Warners even be willing to give them the time, patience to build it from scratch again the way Jeff would want to?
And would you want, yeah, and to build from scratch,
you know, are you going to reboot Superman again this quickly? And then, you know, maybe you start with a different character as the foundation of the DC Cinematic Universe. Would Warner's have paid for that?
Because Warner's going to look at it from the standpoint of, well, we tried that once already with Green Lantern.
Yep. Green Lantern, and it failed. Yep. Exactly. So, I mean, all of these questions we're asking are so valid. But you can't be completely negative about it either. So it's like, there's still so many unknowns about what's going on with regards to these projects. But I'll say this, it's really, really hard to maintain my positivity. I've not been given a concrete reason to. Because I did that for Suicide Squad, and I did it with Batman v Superman. As much as I love the extended cut, the theatrical cut, to me, is an incomplete movie that justifiably, in my opinion, torn down by the critics. And I don't want to see that happen to these next few movies, but I think there's a chance of it. The one thing, though, Nick, if Affleck walks away, I think there's only one choice left to play Batman. You know, they want an older Batman. I think Tom Selleck can get himself in shape.
Oh, I thought you were going to go a different direction. I thought you were going to, you know, suggest that old Alfred could be serving a little BBQ down in the Batcave from time to time.
Quite frankly, no, yeah, not that. Now I would have Jim Ross's heartbeat. Absolutely. Tom Selleck is Batman, and JR is Alfred.
JR is Alfred to Stone Cold Steve Austin's Batman.
Oh, now we're talking. Now we're talking. Hey, Joker, you said you were going to hit me with your little buzzer. That just ain't going to happen.
Oh, man. But no, I mean, like, one thing I want to underscore here is, you know, we've been pretty negative for the last few minutes, but I think it's important to remember that at core, we are DC guys. It's not like we're sitting here and taking shots or casting, you know, doubt on the fate of this, you know, cinematic universe because we take any joy in it. I don't want to do this. I don't want to sit here and have all these concerns. I want to be a blind cheerleader for these DC films, but they've taken that ability away from me at this point. I don't have the blind optimism that some major team fans have out there. I just don't have it, and I wish I did at this point, you know?
Right, and it's, you know, and there are a lot of people out there that love the DC movies. I know people out there that love Suicide Squad, but for somebody that didn't like Suicide Squad, that didn't like the theatrical cut of Batman v Superman, it's hard to view this as somebody who has grown up a DC fan. I've been a DC fan since I was first started reading. First comic book was a DC comic. But I've seen them screw it up so many times up to this point of the fact that they – and we've talked about this before, Nick. They just don't make make enough of the movies.
No, they don't. I mean –
We've had Batman and we've had Superman. And that's it.
Yeah, and the thing is, Greg, it's
and Green Lantern.
It's really hard to build a franchise or a universe or whatever you want to call it on the back of a series of films that is but divisive. I mean, say what you will, film franchises like, I don't know, Transformers or Fast and the Furious, for example, but those franchises have found their audience at this point, and their audience generally enjoys and accepts each installment that comes out. The problem with the DC films is everyone that comes out splits its audience down the middle,
yep.
And some of those people aren't coming back eventually, or they stop coming back. And until you reach a level where you can make just one movie, and I'm not saying one movie that is universally loved the way the first Iron Man was, but make one movie that is generally acknowledged
good.
As being good.
Yep.
And I don't care. Call it safe, which I know that gets tossed, that's been thrown at the Marvel movies or whatever, which is fine. I don't care about safe at this point. Just make a good movie.
Yep. Like, it doesn't have to be Citizen Kane.
Exactly.
It just has to be Lethal Weapon 2, you know?
I mean, yeah, exactly.
For the second time in the podcast.
I am not, as a DC fan, going to sit here and somehow, like, pretend to have the intellectual high ground over Marvel because DC doesn't make safe movies or whatever other, you know, BS term you want to throw on it. I just want a fucking good movie at this point. And while I think Man of Steel is a legitimately good movie, and I think, you know, the extended cut of Batman v Superman is possibly a great movie, we haven't reached that level of acceptance in the general population.
Right. And it's really not that hard.
It's really
these
not.
These characters are just as good as the Marvel characters. It's not like Ant-Man is a better character than anybody that we've seen on the big screen from DC yet. It's just that the movies are made in a way that Batman v Superman took a lot of chances, but at the end of the day, superhero films are popcorn films first and foremost. We've seen movies like The Dark Knight, like Iron Man, that have gone beyond the traditional popcorn summer film, but they're still an entertaining popcorn film at their center, at their core. And I don't know that DC's made that since Chris Nolan left. And they don't have to be, again, they don't have to match The Dark Knight. They don't have to be Chris Nolan level. They just need to be entertaining to general audiences. You need to be able to bring kids and adults and teenagers to the movie theater and watch these movies, and all of them walk out and say, you know what, that was money well spent. I didn't waste my ticket on it.
Absolutely.
And that's another aspect we haven't talked about. DC hasn't made a movie since, and I hate to say this, but they really haven't made a kid-friendly movie since, God, I don't know. I don't know. Green Lantern, I guess. And that was not, and I'm not saying kid-friendly in terms of, you know, they don't need to make cars or whatever, but a movie that parents can take their kids to and not worry about them being shook to their core, basically, while watching the movie, or not having any idea what's going on.
Yeah, I agree. It's that thing that Marvel does so well. I mean, go ahead and watch something like Civil War, which I just rewatched the other day, and there are moments of joy in there. There are those bright, colorful, you know, larger-than-life comic book moments that are clearly meant to speak to a younger audience. But there's also, it's almost like those Marvel movies have something for every audience in them. And it seems like the DC films are seeking to serve particular subsets of the audience that I don't know, you know, are that big.
That's a good point. Both have not. It feels like their audience targeting has not been effective because, again, they don't make enough movies. So I think that just by virtue of sitting on their properties for so long, they have reduced their ability to reach a variety of audiences. If you wanted to take more of a different niche for each group of fans approach, then you have to make more movies so that you're reaching more of those people. And instead, they just haven't. They've sat on the vast majority of their properties. I mean, why are we getting why do we have a Doctor Strange movie and an Ant-Man movie before we ever got a Flash movie?
Or a Wonder Woman movie. Long been the head-scratcher there. Yeah, I agree. And, you know, we talk about the Aquaman movie or the Flash movie or the Green Lantern Corps, but I would remind you once again, Greg, I am of the opinion that we are one Justice League debacle away from none of it ever happening. I think Aquaman happens just because they're in so deep in production at this point, but if November rolls around and Justice League, you know, takes another beating critically, even if it makes money, if it doesn't make, you know, as much as whatever that hypothetical goal that DC has in their head, you know, whether it be $1 billion or whatever, like it was with Batman v Superman, and if they underperform again, I am convinced Aquaman may be the end of the DCEU as we know it.
Yeah, I think you could very well be right about that. WB may pull the rug out from it and just focus on, you know, on the Shazam universe for, you know, try to make that kind of their new focus for a while. I don't know, but we'll see where it all goes from here.
And the one thing we haven't really talked about, Greg, we don't know if this report is true or not, but let's assume that it is true. And the other possibility that's mentioned in this report happens in that Affleck does want out, but they force him to stay. How is that possibly a good scenario? I mean, it's kind of like that classic situation in sports where a player wants out, and do you really want somebody there who doesn't want to be there?
Right. That's why, like, if this report is true, again, I don't know that it is or isn't.
Right.
But if it is true, then it's hard to believe that they would want him to stay on if he's going to, you know, for lack of a better term, half-ass his way through it just to get done with it, you know? He may not even do that. He may figure, you know, I'm going to honor my contractual obligations or whatever.
But again, I don't know if this is true or not, but it's certainly a situation where you'd think you wouldn't want somebody that isn't going to commit 100% to the character. You know, but then again, maybe in their eyes, it's better just not to take the PR hit of him leaving. Maybe that's worth it to them. Clearly, they haven't had a great focus on making sure the final end product was good in the past. So,
yeah, and I mean, if he leaves, like, you're so restricted in what you can do because at this point, you're tied into that idea of an aged Batman. I suppose you could make The Batman as a prequel or a flashback film, but you really can't. You know, you've almost, you know, limited yourself in terms of a potential replacements because you got to go a little bit older.
Like I said, you can go a lot older, and you can go with Tom Selleck as Batman.
That's true. That's true. I still say Austin, but, you know, that's just me. Austin to Jim Ross's Alfred, and I think that's the way you make it.
Well, regardless, we will keep you updated here on what sadly seems to be a weekly segment for us in which we discuss the state of the DCEU. But speaking of DC Comics, let's move from the big screen and move down onto the printed page. And we recently found out, very recently, folks, you have no idea how recently we found this out.
Compared to when we started the last topic, yes, you're right.
Yes, coming to theaters near you are going to be DC Comics commercials. DC Entertainment is partnering with a movie theater advertising company to promote its comic books and partner comic shops. The publisher has recently resumed this agreement with National CineMedia that worked with them on the New 52. You may have seen some ads for that when it happened. And they're going to be 15 to 30-second rebirth commercials that comic book shops can have their contact info added into. Hopefully our local shops will get involved in that. And DC is also offering a 50% reimbursement on these ads if a retailer buys them with National CineMedia. Now, this just makes sense to me. This is something that you and I, Nick, have been, at least I have, I know, been talking about the need for this for years. Warner Brothers is one of the wealthiest corporations in the country. You have to take advantage of that. And if you really want to promote comic books and you want to grow the audience for comic books, take advantage of the millions of people that watch The Flash and Arrow every week and advertise on television.
Which they have started doing. I mean, there have been TV spots in recent weeks and recent months since Rebirth started. So this just seems like another logical step in that direction. I mean, not really much to discuss here. Good idea. Probably long overdue.
Absolutely. Wish. I hope that it takes off and we start seeing a more concentrated effort on promoting these stories. Also at DC, another breaking news story. Bane is getting his own 12-issue limited series. And the big story with that is it marks the return of his original creative team to DC Comics. Chuck Dixon, who is one of the, I would say probably the Batman writer of the 90s. Chuck Dixon, who guided the Cape.
Be up there, wouldn't he? I mean,
He guided the Cape Crusader. He wrote Nightwing, launched the Nightwing solo title, and wrote it for years. The Robin title.
Yeah.
Wrote Birds of Prey. He actually launched Birds of Prey. So one of the most important and sometimes forgotten Batman writers, Chuck Dixon, is returning to DC Comics along with artist Graham Nolan, who was the artist on the introductory Bane storyline, which was Vengeance of Bane, way back in 1993, when I was but 9 years old. And so this is a pretty cool deal. It's a 12-issue series that is going to follow. It's called Bane Conquest, and it's going to reunite Bane, much to my joy, with his three henchmen from Nightfall, Bird, Trog, and Zombie, who I often look up online to find out what happened to them after Nightfall, which the answer appears to be almost nothing. So Bird, Trog, and Zombie are back, and they're going with their boss, Bane, and he will take his criminal ambitions out of Gotham in search of new cities to conquer and new enemies to crush, which is a great description if I ever did read one. Nick, your thoughts on Bane getting his own 12-issue limited?
12 issues sounds a bit much to me. I don't know how much, you know, I know we live in the era of the decompressed story, but that seems a bit overly decompressed me, but still, it's a cool idea, especially getting the original creative team back. And it kind of seems like DC is really focusing on this character right now, between featuring him so heavily in I Am Suicide, giving him the immediate follow-up in I Am Bane. I mean, with this, you're pretty much going to have 2 straight years, almost, of nonstop Bane storytelling. So, good for the Bane fans out there.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So, yeah, that's a pretty cool thing. Big fan of the character Bane when he's done properly, which I feel like he hasn't been at times in the past. And so I'm happy to see him getting a renewed push, because it's a great character that unfairly, I think, gets lumped in with some of the more gimmicky characters of the 90s. Mm-hmm. Very, very good. Very good there. Also want to give a shout out to the CBR story on this for having a great lead to their story. But anyway, let's move over to Marvel, because Marvel had some big announcements recently, Nick. They've unveiled the plans for their next big yearly event in the Neverending Cycle, and this is called Secret Empire.
Right.
And they also announced the launch of a brand new Spectacular Spider-Man book called Peter Parker, The Spectacular Spider-Man. And this is going to have a new creative team for Spider-Man, for Chip Zdarsky, and drawn by Adam Kubert. So this launches on March 6th, it looks like. Is that correct? Wait. Nope. This launches with free.
Yeah. Secret Empire and Spectacular Spider-Man are both going to be – they're going to be co-featured in a one of Marvel's main Free Comic Book Day issues on May 6th, I believe, is the day for Free Comic Book Day this year. So the pitch for Spectacular is pretty much what I've always thought this pitch for Spectacular should be, in that – Zdarsky is saying this is going to be more focused on Peter's personal life, and it is going to be focused entirely on Peter's exploits in New York City rather than the current Parker Industries globe-hopping version of the character that
you love so good.
That I love so good, written by the writer that I love so good, Dan Slott. So, you know, my pull list is so tight that I don't know that I'm even going to be able to add this, but I can see myself picking up an issue at least to boost the number one sales and, you know, hopefully reinforce the fact that this is kind of the more of the approach to Spider-Man that most people would prefer. And most notably, very notably to me, the cover to the number one issue drops the stupid glowing spider symbol thing that they've done since Amazing relaunched after Secret Wars. So that's a good thing. But on the event front, you know, we had talked a couple weeks ago about how Secret Empire was coming. We didn't really know a whole lot about it, but it has pretty much been confirmed now that it's going to be the culmination of the Steve Rogers as Hydra agent storyline, and it's going to feature Steve basically mounting a hostile takeover of the United States for Hydra. So I am I'm very interested in this, which is shocking given how badly Civil War II went, but you know, I've read a few issues now that Captain America Steve Rogers run. I like this little take. I like the subversion on it, and I think it has the potential, like you said all those months ago when it first happened, to provide a new spin on the Captain America Red Skull dynamic, so that when it finally, you know, when Steve finally comes back to his old self and realizes what has happened, it's going to add a whole other level to their dynamic, and I'm interested to see how Marvel pays that off.
Yes, and and it also could lead to our much ballyhooed Red Skull over the top storyline. Mm-hmm. And we can get the immortal line. Sometimes, Herr Capitan, when I turn my hat around backwards, it makes me feel like a truck.
Indeed. But yeah, so, and plus, you know, now, granted, Marvel has said this before, but apparently they're planning on compressing the publication of this story down so that it will kick off in May and wrap up by August, rather than taking up an entire year, or close to a year, the way both Secret Wars and Civil War II did.
But when is the last time that actually happened? The problem with Secret Wars and the other events isn't that they weren't planned to conclude. It's that they had constant delays that pushed them, you know, 6-7 months out from when they were anticipated to end.
Well, this one is going for an even more compressed publishing schedule than those even aimed for originally. Those, even, you know, we're already pushing out towards that six-month mark, and this is trying to compress it into three. So it makes me think that it's going to be able to pull it off, especially because rather than going with one main artist, apparently they're going to rotate art duties between a variety of artists so that you can help get the book out quicker. Let's see. Steve McNiven, Andrea Sorrentino, Lionel Yu, and Daniel Acuna, as well as Mark Brooks on covers, are going to be co-drawing this event together. So unlike something like Civil War II, which, you know, relied almost entirely on the talent of David Marquez, or Secret Wars, which you know, of course, fell into the lap of the outstanding Asad Ribic, this one's going to be, you know, more of a collaborative effort, and I think that might be the solution to getting these events back on a good publishing schedule.
Yeah, it is rather, the quote at the end says, not one, not two, but three separate events break out all at once. Cap, as head of S.H.I.E.L.D., is able to mobilize forces to all three of the situations, and those represent Hydra's first move. So, you know, we'll see where all this goes. Spectacular Spider-Man, big fan of that title. I think it's a book that should always be around in Marvel as long as Marvel's doing well enough to support it. I'm not super familiar with Chip Zdarsky's material.
My limited understanding of his material is that he's typically been more of a comedy writer.
Now, comedy writer, right.
Yeah, I don't want to pigeonhole him necessarily, but I really haven't read enough, and just my, you know, my understanding of his name is that it's largely, you know, attached to comedy-based titles.
Yeah, and that's fine. I mean, Spider-Man, you know,
can support that. Can absolutely support that.
Yeah. So, but it's certainly not a title I'm going to pull, but it may be one that I check out on Marvel Unlimited when it goes up, inevitably when that takes place. Mm-hmm. But very good news on that front for Marvel. And other than that, I think that about wraps us up. Although we do have one late-breaking story that I have to get to. I know this is backtracking to the DC Cinematic Universe. But I have to get to this because The Hollywood Reporter is Hollywood reporting that the Suicide Squad sequel even. I don't know what a sequel is, but
what about a sequel like the Alvin and the Chipmunks movie?
That's what Alvin and the Chipmunks got, and yeah. It was a classic. The sequel to Suicide Squad, they are currently what in the world am I talking about? They are currently aiming for.
Now, this is not. This is. Go ahead.
Warner Brothers is currently courting, is the word here.
Courting
an individual to come in and direct the sequel, and that individual's name is Mel Gibson.
And of course, because they're courting him, they are attempting to show him their sugar tits.
That's correct. And they just bought him flowers and took him out and sent him flowers from 1-800-Flowers. So.
And they're going to blow him because he deserves it.
Mm-hmm. Keep going, Nick.
Those are the main two quotes I remember. You're going to blow me because I deserve it. And then you have to breathe maniacally into the speaker of the cell phone.
That's fine. All I know is Warner Brothers is eyeing him for Suicide Squad 2. And
yeah, they are apparently.
Yep, and I'm down with it. I am
sure
a
that you are.
I am a. I make no apologies for him as a person, for things that he did years ago. No apologies for that at all. But as a director, as an actor, he's one of my favorites of all time. I don't think that he is. I don't think that he has directed a bad movie.
I never saw The Beaver, so I can't really comment on that.
He didn't direct that. Jodie Foster directed.
Oh, that's
that.
Right. Jodie Foster did direct that. You're right.
Yeah. I have.
I want to watch it.
Yeah, I do too. I haven't seen Hacksaw Ridge yet either, but I hear really good things about it.
Isn't it supposed to be getting nominated for various?
Yeah,
awards?
It's up for Best Picture. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's great.
So, Gibson would be a. It would be weird, given some of his comments though about comic book movies. So.
And it would be, I mean, from a PR standpoint, somewhat controversial. Let's be honest.
Certainly.
I mean, fair or unfair, the guy is still looked upon by a lot of people as something of a toxic personality.
Right. But I think that, you know, this would, for me anyway, and I don't understand it'll be controversial, but honestly, I don't care. I want a good movie, and
the guy knows how to make good movies. And I think it would be the most interesting choice for a director DC has ever made for any of their pictures, at least since the Christopher Nolan era ended. So, because listen, I like Zack Snyder, but he does his Zack Snyder thing.
Not
like
counting the Ben Affleck movie that we'll never see.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah. I guess, make it happen.
I guess I'm not as much opposed to the idea of a Mel Gibson DC movie as I am very cool on the idea of a Mel Gibson Suicide Squad movie, if that makes sense. Like,
sure, I get that.
I feel like the foundation that has been set with the squad at this point is so stylized and so moved in one direction that it would take a Herculean, course correction, to get it back to something that I could actually see done through the lens of Mel Gibson. And so I could see
a Mel Gibson Deathstroke movie or a Mel Gibson
a Batman movie. Could absolutely work.
A Mel Gibson Batman movie? Hell yeah. Or he's never directed a Western, but a Mel Gibson Jonah Hex movie seems like it would.
What about a Mel Gibson Gotham Central movie?
There you go. I don't think they'll ever have the balls to make Gotham Central.
Sadly, no.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's a weird fit for the project, but you know, I would be interested in seeing it happen because right now that's about what it would take to get me interested in a Suicide Squad sequel, unless it was just about Deadshot. So, anyway, that was just a little bit of news we wanted to throw at you. There's also some casting rumors from the Fox side that Kerry Washington is being targeted for Domino, which I love. I think that's a great move.
Here's the question.
Wow. Yep.
If she gets cast, do they still paint her white, and do they have to answer constant questions from all the idiots who are going to accuse them of, like, you know, gentrifying a black woman, for lack of a better term?
I didn't even think about that, to be honest. I would think that they wouldn't paint her white. I don't know.
Just a thought. I mean, the character of Domino has always had, like, bleached white skin. Like, not like a white, not like Caucasian skin, literally, like, white skin, you know?
Right. Yeah, no, I know. But, I would be surprised if they did that, but it's not saying they won't. I don't know. I just know I was excited by the casting announcement because she's really good, so.
Not really an announcement yet. I mean, reportedly on the shortlist, according to CBR, from what I read.
Eyeing her, yep. And who can blame them for that? But in other news, I think that's about it, actually, for the rundown. I think we have run
mercifully,
out of things to talk about.
Mercifully brings an end to the rundown.
The rundown finally be over. So let's move on to your favorite segment in ours. Most weeks. Take it away, David.
Read out and watch out. What you be reading and watch out.
What you been reading and watching.
There you have it. And for reading and watching, we've both read our I've met my bare minimum quota of top three books, because I've read three books this week. Mm. Nick, do you have your list prepared?
I have a lengthy list prepared, but I'm gonna let you go first.
Why do I always have to go first? You always make me go first.
Because I have to end the segment with a metric ton of quick hits that you never have. That's why.
Why can't you just do your quick hits after I do my number one?
For God's sake, Greg, just read your damn number three book off the damn list.
Listen who's getting hot, ladies and gentlemen. Listen who's getting their blood pressure worked up. Oh, my. Nick, you need to calm down. You need to take a chill pill. You need to just relax a little bit. You need to do exactly what Batman needs to do.
And that is?
In my number three book of the week.
Oh, I thought you were going to take the prime opportunity. Greg, I just tossed you up a softball and you swung and missed.
I didn't even hear what you said. What'd you say?
You had an opportunity, a golden opportunity to work in an appropriate lighten up, Francis, and you let it slide.
Quite frankly, that's your opinion. But in any event, my number three book of the week happens to be a book that is very, very old. Stop me if you've heard this before. And that would be Detective Comics number 944. And this is the second part of the Victim Syndicate storyline, which I don't think I actually read the first part of the Victim Syndicate storyline because I never got the book in my pull list. So, in any event, nevertheless, this was a good solid comic book here. You know, lots of interesting character interactions, the introduction of this new group, the Victim Syndicate. You know, Batman kind of being told that perhaps he causes more harm than good. The introduction of these characters was kind of interesting. I don't like the name Mudface for a character because it reminds us of Mudbutt from Dave Chappelle.
Mudbutt.
But other than that, this was a good issue. You know, I didn't think it was great, but I thought it was good. Interesting new characters with Mr. Noxious and the Mute. And yeah, another good issue in Detective. I'm glad I'm back to reading this again.
Glad to hear it. Glad to hear it. My number three book of the week is actually a Marvel title, and that, of course, is The Unworthy Thor, number four. This continues the story of Thor and Beta Ray Bill and their new Hellhound friend fighting the forces of Thanos and the Collector while seeking to gain possession of the ultimate Thor, or the ultimate Mjolnir from the Ultimate Universe.
The ultimate Mjolnir!
I like that. Very good. But yeah, just more classic Jason Aaron writing of this character. As I've said, I think he's the best Thor writer of all time. But I have to give a little shout-out to Marvel for, you know, being able to genuinely surprise me. I didn't even know this was happening, but this book actually features about three pages of Asad Rimmich Thor art once more. Granted, it's just him, him drawing a conversation between Thor and Jane Foster, but it doesn't matter. It was Aaron and Rimmich back together again, so big pop for me just for that. Unworthy Thor number four. Excellent, excellent Thor comic.
For at number two for me, I have Action Comics 968, part two of Men of Steel. Really enjoyed this, actually. Thus far, I'm enjoying it a lot more, I think, than Nick did. But this is super entertaining. The involvement of John was tremendous. And much to my surprise, Tyler Kirkham, who's an artist that I'm not a big fan of, usually, he did a great job in this issue of illustrating John and illustrating the fight between Superman and these new, the God Slayer and his little minion there, Zaid. And it was quite a good issue, I thought. Entertaining, action-packed, as we want from Action Comics. And it ended with them taking Lex Luthor, so I'm interested to see where this goes from here. And this creative team, Dan Juergens, Tyler Kirkham, on Detective 944, again, I forgot to mention, James Tynion IV and Eddie Barrows, and Juan Ferreira as well. But, yeah, so this – but, yeah, so Action Comics 968. I'm kind of invested in this now. I want to see where it's going. I continue to be intrigued by this fake Clark Kent. Russell has a theory that he mentioned on Twitter that I don't want to spoil in case he mentions it on his own show. That really, really, really excites me, but I don't want to get my hopes up about it.
Nor do I, for that matter. Moving on to my number two book of the week, it's another Marvel title. It's Jessica Jones, number five. This book is absolutely outstanding because it focuses on what Bendis and the character Jessica Jones have always done best, and that's dialogue. Most of the issue takes place during two separate conversations, one being Jessica Jones and interrogating a murder suspect, and the other being Ben Urich giving Luke Cage a little bit of heart-to-heart advice. Both scenes are absolutely outstanding. The way Jessica responds to what this murder suspect is saying is believable, and the things the guy is saying make a lot of sense. The concept here is that this guy is somebody who has somehow survived the combination of the multiverse at the end of Secret Wars, where basically the entire Marvel multiverse was distilled down into one Earth and then, you know, kind of reborn from there. And this guy is saying, so I killed my wife just because I wanted to prove that nothing matters, because the so-called heroes of this Earth can take actions that cause the deaths of billions, if not trillions of people to just be erased from existence as if they never existed. So what's it matter if I kill one person? And Jessica seemingly kind of sees the point in that. She makes a little bit of a shocking decision at the end of the book, and I'm interested to see if it's just her playing all sides or if she's genuinely being turned against the heroic community. I am very intrigued and wrapped up in this one, continuing to love the direction of this series.
Very good. It sounds almost like a book that could become somewhat attitudinal.
Indeed.
Now, speaking of somewhat attitudinal, my number one book that I read this past week was Detective Comics 945, the third part of the Victim Syndicate story arc. Even though I really don't like the cover of this, which has the spoiler yelling at Batman on the front and kind of an homage to a Silver Age cover, I guess. Just because, as I mentioned on Twitter recently, not a big fan of covers that have text on them. I prefer in general.
Now, wait just a minute, Greg.
There are exceptions. There are always exceptions. I've said that about anything. But I think in general, the best comic book covers to me are the ones that just let the art tell the story.
How can you forget the classic How About It cover of Green Arrow?
Yep. How About It? That's a great cover. Superman burning Jimmy Olsen's Father's Day gift just to be a dick.
Yep.
That's pretty awesome. Superman Superman dropping Aquaman in the desert and watching him drown. Oh, God. Oh, Lord. We need to do a whole podcast just looking at just the covers of Silver Age Superman comics. Anyway, with that being said, this issue was phenomenal, I thought. This was all about Stephanie Brown working through her issues with Batman and just laying it on him, just talking about how irresponsible he is, how selfish he is, how caught up in himself that he is. And she tells all this stuff to him, and then he ends up proving her right by the end of the issue because he tries to trick her into revealing information that he needs. And she catches on to it at the end. So this is if you're a fan of Stephanie Brown, which I've never really been in the past, I don't know much about the character beyond, you know, her rather unconvincing run as Robin back in the mid-2000s. But if you're a fan of Stephanie Brown, this is the issue for you because she really gets the better of Batman in these verbal exchanges. And it's a very emotional issue, and it's Bruce having to come to terms with some things about himself and deal with some of his own issues that are related to Tim Drake's apparent death and that are related to the injury that Stephanie Brown suffered and just the idea that perhaps these villains that are coming after him have a point after all. The fact that he can no longer remember the names of the innocent victims of his first few forays into the crime-fighting business. It's a really, really good, powerful issue by James Tynion IV, and, oh boy, let me see if I can get this name said correctly. Al Barrionuevo, I think is how you pronounce this, along with Carmen Carnero, who also penciled pages in this one. So, good issue, big fan, Detective Comics 945.
Excellent, glad to hear that. So, moving on from one Batman book to another, my number one book of the week is All-Star Batman number 7. As I said last week, this is a book that is finally living up to its true potential. Scott Snyder at one point described this book as his version of The Long Halloween, and kind of what I had envisioned in that was this massive story that kind of involved all the different major Batman villains. And what we got to begin with was just one story arc that was, for the most part, largely focused on just Two-Face. Well, after doing a standalone Mr. Freeze issue, we're jumping straight from that into a Poison Ivy issue that has something of a loose tie to the Freeze issue, but isn't really narratively connected. And as such, they swap artists from Jock over to Tula Lote, who I don't really know that much about, but she does an outstanding job in this one with Poison Ivy. This is a version of Poison Ivy that I've never really read before. It kind of brings something new to the character and isn't really the typical seductress take on the character that they have gone with for so many years.
No Uma Thurman to be found?
No Uma Thurman to be found, exactly. Continues the practice of using a lot of prose in it, although it isn't entirely prose-focused the way that issue 6 was, but this has all of a sudden become just another Scott Snyder classic Batman story in the course of, like, 2 issues. So I am loving the hell out of this All-Star Batman. Can't wait to see what they do next month as the Mad Hatter becomes the villain of the month.
Ah, the Mad Hatter, who I'm sure is currently doing great work on Gotham right now. So,
well, and you know, he's going to have to tear himself away from the Joker, begging for, you know, certain favors that we don't really feel like we need to say right now.
That's right. We don't mean to tell tales out of skew. So let's move on to your bottom book of the week.
My bottom book of the week. Yet again, another week where I didn't really read a bad book, but if I have to pick one, I'm going to go with Titans number 8. And the reason for this is, one, I think the art slips back a little bit. I thought Brett Booth was very strong during the end of the previous story arc, but he kind of slips back a little bit here. And also, this story heavily focuses on the characters of Mal Duncan and Bumblebee, two characters who I've never really known a lot about nor cared a lot about. So,
yeah, I remember their episode or their stuff on Young Justice was always the least interesting.
It was always the least interesting. So just because of that, it takes home my bottom book of the week.
Very good. What about your quick hits?
Quick hits. Wonder Woman number 16 brings on a new artist who I can't remember the name of, but she does a very good job, to say the least. New storyline called God Watch that's going to kind of focus on the idea of what happens to humanity when not just Wonder Woman, but other gods are starting to take a more active role in day-to-day life, and some of them don't necessarily have the best of intentions in mind. Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 14 features a Hal and Kyle team-up, and the long-awaited return of St. Walker continues to be a great Green Lantern read. Star Wars Dr. Aphra number 4, still, Kieran Gillen is just killing it with this character, and you know, 000 and BT continue to steal every damn scene they're in. Justice League of America Rebirth number 1, continuing a line of very good Rebirth specials they've done for this series, and this might have been, I don't know, I think the Killer Frost one was still the best one yet, but this one is great, and it's expertly drawn by Ivan Reiss, and plus, each character gets a moment to shine, which is key. Batgirl and the Birds of Prey number 7 picks up a new storyline called Soldiers of Fortune. Really enjoyed this one. Really continue to enjoy this book. And even the art is starting to grow on me a little bit. And plus, it just feels like the Benson sisters who are writing this just kind of have a great handle on what makes each bird of prey unique and distinct from the other. So, Action Comics 973. Big bounce, big bounce back for this one. I know you're enjoying the Men of Steel storyline. I wasn't huge on it. But this one appears to be a storyline that's going to focus largely on the mystery behind this new Clark Kent, so I found this a lot more interesting.
What do you personally have a theory yet about the mystery Clark Kent?
I do not. There is a moment here where they visit Clark Kent's apartment or whatever, and some things happen that make me wonder. I don't know. I don't think it's Superman Prime, although I want to be wrong. I'll put it that way. Sorry. Moving on. Detective Comics, number 950. This is a oversized anniversary special and a prologue to League of Shadows, although I'm not really sure how it's a prologue to the League of Shadows storyline, because it seemingly doesn't have anything to do with it. It's a collection of little stories featuring each member of the team here, and they're all okay, but none of them really knocked my socks off. It's probably actually one of the weaker issues of Detective Comics that's happened since Rebirth relaunch, which is sad considering the significance of hitting the 950 number. And finally, Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows number 4. A solid read, if probably the weakest issue of the series thus far. Plus, it continues the series' rapidly growing tradition of giving their characters terrible new code names as Annie takes on the code name of Spiderling, which I think is pretty bad, personally. So, those be my quick hits.
Very good, Mr. Lau. Very good, Mr. Lau. Well, let's move on to watching. As certainly we've had quite a few things to watch, haven't we, Nick?
Indeed, we have.
We should mention we still have not watched Legion, although I am going to be watching it. I have it on my DVR. I will be watching Legion. I just have not Have not had an opportunity to do so yet, but I look forward to it. Oh, and also, for David Sunday's pleasure, could you say deluge real quick, Nick?
No.
Fair enough. So, I have not watched Legion, but what
deluge.
I have... What was that?
Deluge.
Oh, very good, very good. I believe he wants you to say it in the Jim Ross parlance of deluge.
Deluge.
There we go. Now, let's. Should we start with the CW shows, or should we start with the much anticipated return of AMC's The Walking Dead?
You know what, Greg? Let your conscience be your guide.
Well, let's go in chronological order then. Let's just start on Monday.
All right. Monday.
With Supergirl on the CW. This was an episode largely focused on the Martians, Jon Jones and Magan Moores, the Miss Martian and Martian Manhunter. And usually when they focus on those characters, it makes for a very strong episode. That did not prove to be the case in this situation. The there was a white Martian on the loose at the DEO, and the idea of the episode, most of the episode anyway, was who is the white Martian in disguise?
Right. The DEO went into lockdown, and so it was like this. It's almost like they try to do a horror themed episode of Supergirl. So it's a great premise. Like, yeah, A for effort. You know, on the concept.
Yeah. Execution left a lot to be desired.
I would agree.
Yeah.
Including what is probably the worst CGI of the show to this point.
Yeah. Terrible CGI on all of the the white Martian transformations were just really bad. And to compensate for it, they seemingly went into what felt like a barrage of slow motion action scenes that...
I think because the motion blur was so noticeable when they went, you know, full speed because of the poor quality of the CGI, I think they were trying to use the slow motion to mask how bad the CGI was, which backfired because then you had more time to notice the lack of detail on the CGI creations and see how bad the CGI was.
Yeah, it was. I mean, but it took me right out of the episode. The action scene, it was just so.
What a great.
Overbearing the slow motion on these scenes. There was also the continuation of the last couple weeks theme of Kara kind of not acting like Kara. She was kind of mean to her sister, Alex. She was mean to Mon-El. And just in general seems to have this weird like... it's just not. It's not the sweet.
I thought they did a decent enough job of explaining that, though, in that she's somewhat lost because she feels for the first time in her life like she and her. There's some sort of gap between she and her sister.
Yes, I would agree with that to an extent. The stuff with her and Alex actually didn't bother me as much as her conversation with Mon-El, because I thought she was so jerky in that conversation about how she referred to someone like him and, you know, stuff like that. It just didn't seem like the Carrie and Kara that we're used to. Granted, she's trying to cover up her feelings, obviously, but she's by and large one of the best characters on television, so it's always frustrating when she acts kind of out of character like that. Although I will say, people do that. So, you know, it is nice to see that she still has flaws and that she is not the stereotypical boy or girl scout that the super characters are often accused of. But overall, very, very weak episode, I thought. Maybe one of the worst of the series to date.
I wouldn't go quite that far. I think I enjoyed it, you know, a little bit more than you did, but I would agree it was a fairly weak episode. I actually thought it was probably better than the week that preceded it with, you know, the one that was so Guardian heavy.
Oh, Guardian. No Guardian in this episode. That was a big positive.
Exactly. Big plus. Big plus.
Big plus. Well, let's move on to Tuesday night. And we had another rousing edition of The Flash. Mm-hmm. This one, if my memory serves me, this one was focused on this new character that comes to town that has the ability to essentially create death with his touch. Not unlike Black Hand, actually.
Yeah, although a bit slower process than Black Hand is. Black Hand pretty much touches people and they die.
Right.
Whereas this guy kind of has it appears to be some sort of rapid aging / decay process.
Yep. Which, on the contrast from Supergirl on Monday, I thought the effects on this were really good.
Right, yep. I completely agree. I thought they did a good job of, you know, showing the transitions in the in his various victims from, you know, their young and youthful states to their old and broken states.
From their number two to their Frau.
Yep.
And I thought it was a really good episode. The continuing build of Wally West as being a big hero in his own right, although he's clearly starting to get an ego about it, which is in keeping with Wally West's characterization, by the way. So I've got no issues with that. And also, H.R. Wells just continues to be awesome. I love how he just blatantly repeats everything that everyone says in the room around him, but says it as if he's got some, you know, genius revelation to make, you know?
Right.
Great stuff from all of the cast. Really interested in how this Savitar storyline is going to turn out. And once again, I can't say enough for, as far as like a complete ensemble and everybody having great chemistry with each other, The Flash probably has the best top to bottom cast of the four CW shows. And Legends is pretty close in that regard, but everyone on the show that's a series regular, they just fit with one another. Even Julian has fit in really well. So, kudos to The Flash.
Absolutely. Caitlin, even, I thought, got a great moment.
Great
moments this week as she was attempting to save Iris's life. So, yeah, strong subplots for pretty much every character. Although, I will say, I hope we don't get subjected to a whole lot more of Joe's potential future stepdaughter, because the acting was not exactly great on that character, in my opinion.
Yeah, I can see that. I think that was primarily on there to feed Wally's ego a little bit. But yeah, not the strongest in that department. But let's move on to what will be the most fun to talk about.
Yes.
Which is a Revolutionary War episode of Legends of Tomorrow, in which the Legends crew travels back to the 1770s to
save the life of George Washington.
Yep, founding father George Washington. And along the way, we find out, much to our surprise, that much of General Washington's tactics that he learned about war and how to help defeat the British and how to lead our country, he learned from none other than Mick Rory, a.k.a. Heatwave.
This episode is pretty much, if I were going to show somebody one Mick Rory episode ever, this is probably it. Because it opens, and the opening of the episode pretty much tells you Mick is about to own this episode from beginning to end. Because they continue off the motif of riffing on the little opening narration by having Mick deliver the opening narration and make fun of it the entire time he's doing it. And finish it off by saying, "Who the hell writes this crap?" And then they go straight into the episode, and Mick just kills every single scene that he's in. And at the end, when they do the big reveal of how history has changed, and they show the statue of Mick Rory in Washington, D.C., it got a legitimate out loud pop for me. That was just a wonderful touch. Everything in this episode that had to do with Mick and Georgie, as he kept calling him, was absolutely perfect.
Yeah, wonderful. Wonderful episode of this show that has been absolutely killing it since the midway point, since they came back from the break, really all season long. But these last few episodes have just felt like they're on a different level. Mick continues to steal the show. Sarah is doing great as captain. Rip Hunter as a brainwashed villain has been really entertaining, I thought. Much to my surprise, I figure they'd go with kind of the, almost like his emotions have been turned off kind of deal. But instead, we're getting actually a more sarcastic, more emotional version of Rip Hunter, as a villain, and it's really working for me in that regard. That was cool. That was funny. Seeing Jax step up and really have a more important role on the show has been cool. I've enjoyed his dynamic. Him and Martin together are always good. I actually enjoyed seeing – I know the CGI was not great necessarily, but I actually enjoyed little Ray Palmer, you know, the Atom being chased by the rat in the ventilation shaft. So just an entertaining episode that allows you to kind of turn your brain off and have a good time every time you watch it. So I would highly recommend people to check out Legends if they never have. Because it just continues to entertain every single week.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Now, that leads into Wednesday night, which was a new episode of Arrow. And this episode involved Oliver taking his team, which includes the newest addition, Dinah Drake, a.k.a. soon to be the Black Canary, taking the team with him to Russia in an attempt to tie up a loose end, if you will, which is the general who framed John Diggle earlier in the season for war crimes. Well, that general escaped from his prison and led his group overseas to Russia. Oliver went over there, met with Anatoly, and had to tie up some old issues with him. And in the midst, we got some more great flashbacks of Oliver and Talia al Ghul as she is leading him through training and trying to convince him to return to Starling City to pick up the mission that his father envisioned for him.
Speaking of those flashback scenes, Greg, did you notice the little Easter egg there during one of those scenes?
Maybe, maybe not. What was it?
So what I believe is the second flashback scene of last week's episode, it's basically Oliver and Talia having a conversation in this remote like location or whatever, and the camera is doing this pan, you know, kind of thing where they're panning around them, and they're standing on either side of this table, and in the center of the table is sitting not a power battery, but a literal Green Lantern is sitting in the middle of the table as these two characters have the conversation.
I did not notice that. I did not notice that. No. That's awesome.
Yep. Yeah, it was awesome. Although it continues to just, it makes me wonder if they're just teasing us with no intention of ever you know, paying it off.
That was good. That's great. I never noticed that. I'm glad you mentioned that, Nick. But yeah, so we get those great flashbacks. We get the stuff in Russia. We get some. What I thought, I got to give it credit, Nick, and I have actually watched this week's episode, but I won't spoil it for you. But I'm impressed with what they're doing with Wild Dog. They're turning the corner on him a little bit. I really enjoyed the stuff with him and Quentin Lance back in Star City. I enjoyed all the stuff in Russia. Anatoly, as you know, Nick, is a personal favorite character of mine on Arrow. Always has been. And I was just really impressed with this episode. I'm digging where it's going. They tried to fit a lot into this episode, but I thought it all worked for the most part.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I'm really, really digging what they're doing and how they're getting to the core of Oliver Queen this season and introducing some new characters along the way that are starting to hit. You know, it took a long time for Wild Dog to get off my shit list, but he's starting to get there. And the new Black Canary, hey, she had a great scene with Diggle. So
and she had a great scene with Oliver this week.
Yep.
Where basically she it's just so, like I've said before, this character is just so much more like the Black Canary from the comics because, you know, Oliver is doing his typical Oliver thing where he's trying to take the blame and blame himself for everything and basically, you know, sulk about it. And she calls him out on this after barely knowing him essentially and says, oh, I get it. You're just going to internalize everything and think that everything's your fault. Real original, basically, and just kind of takes him to task for it. And it was absolutely fantastic. It felt in character for her as opposed to, like, annoying when Laurel used to do it. So I continue to love this new Black Canary.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Even if you made her sound a little bit like JR when she was talking to Oliver. Oh, that's real original. That's real cute.
I have to acknowledge that was kind of what I was thinking the entire time I was watching the scene, so.
Oh my gosh! Imagine
it sounded
JR.
A lot like all. It sounded a lot like JR dialogue. I can't help it.
Imagine JR in those fishnets.
Oh, sauce it, baby.
Sauce it. So yeah, another really, really strong episode of Arrow. I felt so. Let's go ahead and rank our CW shows before we touch on The Walking Dead. Nick, I'll start with you.
Legends, Arrow, Flash, Supergirl.
Same for me. Legends, Arrow, Flash, Supergirl. And I would again, it makes it sound like we didn't enjoy Flash. Flash was really good, but that's how great Legends and Arrow were this week. So
yeah, Legends and Arrow, to me, are operating on this whole other plane right now. Not to say Flash hasn't been good. Flash has been very good. It's just those other two shows seem to be knocking it out of the park for me each and every week in almost every respect.
Agreed. Now, let's move on to the mid-season premiere of AMC's The Walking Dead. And this was an episode that kind of picks up after the big the episode that we both had a lot of praise for, the mid-season finale, which Walking Dead always does a good job with. This picks up on the thread that now Rick and his team are convinced that they need to fight back against the Saviors. And this is about them realizing that they have to gather the forces needed to do that. So now they're trying to recruit from the hilltop as well as from the kingdom to join their cause. And this involves them trying to seek help, of course, from King Ezekiel, or as Rick calls him, Kang Ezekiel. So Rick takes Coral to see Kang Ezekiel.
I knew you were going to work in Coral.
And yep. They have proceeded to have what was a really good first half of the episode. This is just my opinion, of course. I thought it was a really good, really entertaining first half of the episode. And then it turns into a pretty boring second half of the episode where Rick and the crew go back to Alexandria, go through this overly elaborate bomb thing that I still don't really understand the point of or why we needed to see it. And then they get back to Alexandria and
I think the idea was to begin the process of building up the Alexandrian arsenal once more and kind of show you just how important every weapon and every munition is to them at this point, every resource, so to speak.
Yeah, I guess it was just kind of boring to me, like watching them, you know, pull dynamite out of tape or whatever for 10 minutes. But, I mean, Rambo does it in like 3 minutes, but... You know, they're not Rambo, I know. But all that being said, I still enjoyed the episode. I thought it was pretty good. It did fall into what I think has been a trend for The Walking Dead. Their mid-season premieres don't tend to be very good in terms of, like, being memorable. You know, the pudding episode, I believe, was a mid-season premiere.
Really? Huh.
I think it was. It was either that or it was, like, the second episode after the mid-season premiere. Again, this wasn't the worst mid-season premiere. I liked it overall. It just, I think it could have been a little bit more exciting. And I wish it had, I wish it had given us more of King Ezekiel because he's great when he's doing the king character, if you will.
Right. And I think the great thing about the first half of the episode was that it cut a pace completely unlike anything else we've seen this season because while you and I are generally higher on this season than most. I think we would both would agree that it's had issues with, you know, taking too much time unnecessarily, devoting entire episodes to, you know, places and subplots that it doesn't really need to spend entire episodes. So I was a little surprised with the beginning of this one how we jump, you know, from the hilltop to the kingdom and then out onto the open road so quickly. Mm-hmm. So that when in the back half it slowed down, it felt very disappointing because it felt like they were reverting back to some of their you know weaker tendencies from earlier in the season.
Well, and it felt like inverted pacing in that you want an episode in general or anything you want it to build to a crescendo, and instead it felt like the crescendo was at the beginning and then it gradually slowed to a crawl, kind of like the Randy Orton Triple H match from WrestleMania 25. For those who would like to add yet another thing to the list.
Yep.
So that inverted structure didn't serve the episode well, in my opinion. But I still enjoyed it overall. Did you catch the Negan line on the walkie-talkie?
You said it was one line. It was an entire, like, little monologue there he gave about Fat Joey.
Fat Joey, yeah. Now, when Fat Joey died, that left only Thin Joey, and now Thin Joey was just Joey. And who wants that, you know?
Fat Joey and Thin Joey, that's good. That's good. Hopefully, you know, I know that Fat Joey wasn't, but in my mind, they're both played by Dave Coulier.
Hey, cut it out.
It's you know, 1992 Dave Coulier and current day Dave Coulier, and I'll leave it up to you to determine which one is Fat Joey and which one is Thin Joey.
Are they still doing the Mr. Woodchuck show? That's all that really matters.
Oh my God, how could they not, Greg? How could they not? Everybody needs a little levity in the Walking Dead universe at this point. And I must mention, I am convinced now that there's a lot of potential, Greg, in an eventual spinoff show focusing on the comedic stylings of Jerry and Dr. Eugene Porter singing songs together.
Jerry with his look of joy at Rick's story that he was telling. That was...
Jerry was enthralled. Nice. They need to do more of this Jerry character. I like the cut of his jib, so to speak. But yeah, liked the episode, didn't love it. So yeah, that's pretty much where I am on it.
Who has the funnier accent at this point? Kang Ezekiel or Rick?
Oh, absolutely Rick, because Ezekiel to me is a joy. Like,
yes,
The Walking Dead, you know, can take itself so seriously at times. And yeah, Don't get me wrong, for the most part, I like that. But I think it needs those handful of characters,
yep,
who enable you to recognize the absurdity of the show, who seem to recognize what kind of world they're actually living in. And King Ezekiel, to me, every time he's on screen, is just, it's different. It's a breath,
yeah,
of fresh
air.
It reminds
me of Thor trying to have a conversation with Tony Stark or something, you know?
Right, like, yeah, it's great.
Wouldst thou dine with us tonight?
I will render my decision in the morn. It's just all this, it's great, man. And like, you know, I think at this point, Ezekiel is...
What he said, we invite you to sup with us tonight.
Yes. Yes.
Wonderful.
But yeah, I think Ezekiel at this point is as essential to the show as someone like Eugene, who I've mentioned before, you know, not, you know, my overstated love of the character aside, I think Eugene fills an absolutely essential role in that he's the rare comedic relief character, which a show that can be as bleak as The Walking Dead still needs. And so I think with the cast expanded as much as it is at this point, you need more than one of those characters. And Ezekiel is the rare character who can fill both comedic relief and still serve a dramatic purpose. So loving that character to this point in the season.
Is there any doubt that one guy that is Ezekiel's right-hand man that really wants them to fight, that he's gonna be one of the first to die?
I have a hard time. He's either going to be one of the first to die or stupidly betray them somehow.
Yep, I think you're right on that. But overall, I thought it was a solid episode. And
yeah,
I think we're going to get it ramped up here in the near future, hopefully. And should be interesting to see how all that goes. Also, I really hope they do an episode, or at least half an episode, where we see just Daryl wandering through the kingdom and trying to avoid killing everyone around him.
Yes, trying to cope with what's going on.
Yes. In any event, that wraps up watching for the week.
Oh, speaking of which, coping with what's going on, how great was the reaction of the Alexandrians the first time they met Ezekiel?
Oh, yes.
And they just all freeze in the – like, and they kind of look at Jesus as if Jesus has lost his damn mind.
Yep.
Perfect. Laughed out loud, which doesn't often happen with The Walking Dead.
Look, Ezekiel. Kang, Ezekiel. We're just here to talk to you. Oh, man. Phenomenal. Yeah, that was great. That was great.
They should get Andrew Lincoln's Rick to play Mr. Fantastic in the Fantastic Four reboot, just so he can face off against Kang the Conqueror.
But would he then become King the Conqueror?
Well, that, you know, that's a great question. That's one that, you know, we can't really answer until it happens.
What we need is Julianne Moore from Hannibal to hook up with Rick on The Walking Dead. That's what we need.
And the great thing about Julianne Moore from Hannibal is she would go back and forth between King Ezekiel and Kang Ezekiel.
Yes.
You would never really be able to tell when it was going to happen.
Couldn't quite pin down where she's from.
or why the switch was going to happen or what the rhyme or reason was to her accent, but you would just know that, you know, every so often there was going to be a weird shift in the accent.
Yeah.
Much like, you know, she and Taylor Kitsch from X-Men Origins Wolverine could have a lot in common. Which
good
day,
sir. I'm Remy. Go ahead.
Which is a great transition since we're wrapping up this episode to talking about what we got coming down the pike. Because, you know, next week, as we've talked about, we've got our top five Marvel stories ever in addition of Countdown. But we can now reveal that March is going to be Wolverine month. And one of the episodes that will be featured that month is an off-the-page look at X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Yes, it is.
In addition to that, we'll also be featuring a Long Book Hunters on the first volume of the Andrea Sorrentino and Jeff Lemire Old Man Logan series, a very special feature-length, a full-length review of the new film Logan, and a countdown of our top five X-Men the Animated Series episodes. So, big Wolverine-themed month coming up here in March.
Ooh, very good, very good, very good. Yes, you get to hear Taylor Kitsch go from "My name is Remy LeBeau" to "My name is Remy LeBeau" to "One name's Remy LeBeau," all in the course of one movie. So,
yep,
look forward to that.
And don't forget, you get Buffalo Blob in that movie as well.
Oh, wait. Am I a great big frat person? And
no,
the answer is yes.
No,
Yes, he is. Oh, is he about a size 15? 14? Damn it. One of those two. Which one is it, Nick? Is it 14 or 15?
I think it's 14.
I think so, too. The only answer for this is to watch Silence of the Lambs again. But that is neither here nor there. Buffalo Bill, with his old weight, is neither here nor there. We come to the end of another journey here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We hope you enjoyed our discussion today of all the news and the news and notes. We hope you enjoyed our discussion of Batman Under the Red Hood. And please, we invite you to let us know what your thoughts were on Batman Under the Red Hood. Where does it rank in the DC animated pantheon? Did it work for you? Did it not work for you? Were there things you didn't like about it? Let us know on Twitter.
And if it didn't work for you, what is wrong with you and why are you broken inside?
That's right. Let us know on Twitter at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. Join us on Place to Be Nation Comics on Facebook, at Place to Be Nation Comics, and join
on
our
Facebook
group. And you will be able to comment at your leisure and let us know why we were right and why we are the greatest podcasters known to man. Also, while you're here on Place to Be Nation Pop, check out all the other great shows we got on here. We're talking Geek and Sassy. We're talking Seller's Points. We're talking Conversation Comics, where Todd and Tim are taking us through the X-Men pantheon of Chris Claremont and John Byrne. We're talking Imaginary Stories, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA B-Team. Is that correct?
NBA team.
NBA team. NBA, they're not a B-Team. Virgil is leading the NBA B-Team, actually, right
Shots
now.
Shots fired from Greg Phillips at the folks over at the NBA.
No,
I would not stand for it if I were one Andrew Reich. That's all I'm
saying. I love me some Andrew Reich. I'm just saying, I've got
to say that now.
Because
you
Virgil
just basically compared him to Scott Flash Norton. That's what you did.
I did not compare him to Scott Flash Norton. First of all, Scott Flash Norton wasn't that bad. Second of all,
good Lord, Greg, in terms of controversial things you've ever said on this podcast, I think Scott Flash Norton wasn't that bad might be the weakest take you've ever had.
Hey,
he was awful. Awful.
I'll die on that. Listen, man, he was one half of Vicious and Delicious. He was the vicious
good
half
Lord.
Of Vicious and Delicious.
Good Lord.
Well, with all that being said, folks, do let us know what you think about our podcast and all the other great podcasts here at Place to Be Nation Pop. Also, we just launched the Dad podcast here at PTB and Pop, so that should be an interesting one. They're probably going to reach out to you for that one soon, I'm sure.
Oh,
so
I posed a theory, or not a theory, but just a dilemma I've been wrestling with in my head for some time, and I think they're going to talk about it on a future episode. So I'm interested to hear their take on that. And that theory is I don't trust Goofy. I don't trust him. There's something wrong with him, Greg, and he's not to be trusted. He something about him just
Gorsh.
There are secrets.
Gorsh.
There are secrets being kept. And I think, you know,
at least he wears pants, unlike Pluto.
You're not thinking critically, Greg. You're not thinking critically. Think about it. Pluto is a dog, correct?
Yep.
Goofy is also a dog, correct?
Yep.
Why is Goofy walking on two legs? Why does he have the ability to speak when Pluto doesn't? Where did Goofy gain this biological advantage over his canine counterparts? What makes him so much better than everybody else? I think there's...
Or perhaps you're asking the wrong questions. What makes Pluto so much worse than everyone else?
No, because see, then you got to remember that that Goofy is the only character in the Disney, you know, the core Disney group that we know for a fact has ever procreated as a result of the show Goof Troop from the 90s, mm-hmm. if you recall. Mm-hmm. Where's the mother, Greg? What happened to the mother? She mysteriously disappeared.
Are you suggesting that there's more than meets the eye when it comes to the Goofy family history?
I'm just saying that this Goofy character, you know, I don't trust him. I think he's a trickster, a crack smoking swindler, and that's all.
So
you're saying
that he shares some qualities in common with Aaron Rodgers of the Green Bay Packers?
You know, big butt having.
Okay. All right. We're not going to cast any more aspersions on Goofy or Aaron Rodgers. Nonetheless, we do come to the end of another labyrinthine episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We've taken you here. We've taken you there. We've taken you to things that have nothing to do with comics. But, hey, That's what we do here. That's why they pay us the big bucks. So let us know what you think about the show. Nick, do you have anything else to add to our wonderful studio audience here in Vancouver, British Columbia?
No.
Very good. And as always, I'll try to leave you with a final thought. And this is my final thought. Hens love roosters. Geese love ganders. Everyone else loves Ned Flanders. See you next week.
Why did you do that in Vince Russo voice?
I've decided that I want to do everything in Vince Russo voice now. Like when I'm going to get my taxes done tomorrow, and I'm planning on going in and doing the Vince Russo voice the entire time. I'm going to sit down with my taxes. I'm going to put them on the table.
Sit down with your tax person and be like, bro, I swear to God.
As God as my witness, bro, it never happened. Never, ever happened. Okay, here's what happened.
Sir, the IRS is saying that you owe this amount. I mean, they have documentation.
Tax account lady, I swear to you, this is what happened. And tax account lady, across my heart this happened. I walked into the office. I told them what I was going to do. They told me I was okay to do it. And then they screwed me. They screwed me. The sons of bitches, they screwed me. And that's why, tax account lady, I swear to you, that's what happened.
Well, with all that being said,
join us next week, folks.
This is making me sick. Is it over? No, not yet. Referee Earl Hebner is always in my ass. That's a little weird. Transmission. He's got a first-class ticket to my ass. Executioner. Here comes Maven. Raven. What? Jim Ross. Now, let's not give anyone some bad idea. There's going to be plenty of turbulence in my ass. Booker T is an idiot. It's not the rock bottom. It's my ass.
Are you serious?
The poison has now been injected into my ass. This is not right, King. The poison is not going to stop until they wipe my ass. I can think of about 7,000 or 8,000 things I'd rather have in my ass.
I don't even care anymore.
Look at the confident expression on my ass.
The fat lady's singing now.
He's only got one thing on his mind, and it's my ass.
My granny is the most feared object of pain.
Everyone, don't forget to visit myass.com for great WWE products.
Oh, yeah. Didn't see that coming. It's about as effective as a one-legged man
in my ass.
Like taking candy from a baby.
I'm going to tell you the truth right now. I've known JR for 20 years, and he don't give a damn about the fans. He's a glory hound, and he just doesn't want to hang it up.
He doesn't want to admit that his days are over.
Oh! Boom shakalaka! Boom shakalaka! Boom shakalaka! Boom shakalaka! Boom shakalaka! Boom shakalaka!
Old school. The big man is back. Anyway, I have some news here for you. Kiss my ass, lousy bastard. That's all.
Oh my God! Boom shakalaka! Boom shakalaka! Boom boom shakalaka! Boom shakalaka! Boom 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 boom!
Give it to him! Give it to him!
Shakalaka! Jim Ross
is every woman's dream and every man's nightmare.
It's assault and battery.
Oh!
Oh yeah! Nothing could stop that Oklahoma stampede.
Don't do it!
Boom shakalaka!
Oklahoma.
Boom shakalaka!
Good old
boom
K-R.
Shakalaka! Boom shakalaka! Boom shakalaka! Boom shakalaka!
Old school. The big man is back.